Joe Rogan Podcast. Check it out.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan Podcast by night, all day.
We're up. Mr. Hennessy.
Mr. Rogan.
Fun hanging with you today.
It's been a blast.
That fucking vehicle that you have built is the most ridiculous thing I've ever been inside in my life. I can't believe how fast it is.
Well, like, we only did a speed limit today, right?
Yes. But we got there very quickly.
We got there very quickly. Yes. Yeah. 1,817 horsepower and 3,000 pounds. So you got some power to weight ratio to work with there.
That's like 700 more horsepower than a Tesla Plaid.
Yeah, it's like taking a McLaren 765 LT and adding 1,000 horsepower to it. Something nobody needs, but we've sold 36 of those, the Venom F5.
What happened to you in your life that you needed to make these preposterous cars?
Well, you know.
Like, what is going on? Like, what?
Yeah, there it is. That's the Venom F5.
How did you get to be this guy? Like, what did? How did this start out? Where you're making these 1,800 horsepower
cars?
It's
probably kind of like, you know, the pool hall deal when we were younger. Like, I didn't have a good relationship with my old man. He was a car guy, but we didn't get along. And I don't know, maybe 60 years later, you know, I'm 60 now. I've got, you know, I still feel like I got a little chip on my shoulder, something to prove. Maybe a little bit less now, but for sure.
Isn't it interesting that you would never want that for your son?
No.
But boy, is that a great motivating factor for success.
Sure. For sure, yeah. I'd live up, you know, grew up in a kind of an abusive situation and neglect, and, you know, now all of a sudden I've got all this motivation, or I've had all this motivation for the last, you know, 40 years of my business career, so it's been good.
It's funny, because you would never want that for your children.
No, I mean,
it's amazing how well it's worked out for people like you, or for me.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I don't think everybody out there that has some level of success has not necessarily been abused and motivated by negativity, but I can definitely see with our five kids, with the nurture mainly from my wife, Hope, they're going to turn out just fine and they'll be plenty successful. But, you know, that's just, I don't know your story, but that's my road, how I got here.
It can lead you to be very ambitious and very successful, but it can also just fuck your life up.
Oh, sure.
And you can be very ambitious and very successful and also be, like, happy. Like, that's possible.
Absolutely.
Too. That's possible, too.
Yeah.
You don't have to have a tortured childhood.
For sure. No, I'm very, very blessed. I mean, you know, to have an opportunity to build toys for people, you know, whether it's a 700,000-800,000 horsepower pickup truck or a Venom F5, you know, we were talking earlier, it's about first world problems, right?
Yeah. You know,
something nobody really needs. Nobody needs to go to a comedy show or MMA, but they do it for entertainment. I tell people all the time, we're more. Are those stars up there?
Yeah, they fly.
Oh, wow. Am I in the Rolls Royce?
There's a shooting star.
After the Ric Flair gummy bear, they're going to really start flying.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now I feel very blessed, and we're definitely, you know, people come to us because they want to entertain themselves with their vehicles.
That's a great way of looking at it, too, because that's really what those kind of cars are. Like, when I try to describe my love of old muscle cars for people, because, you know, they kind of are not super reliable.
Yeah.
They're not so great at handling.
Sure.
And, you know, so I get them done into resto mods.
Yeah.
But still, but when I drive them, the experience is entertaining. It's like a ride. Like, I'm not just in a Corolla. I'm not just in some quiet Subaru. I'm in a ride.
But does it take, like, when you drive your Land Cruiser, you drive, you know, one of your older cars, does it take you back to that time either when you had that car, you aspired to have that car, you knew the guy or the girl that had that car kind of growing up, and you wanted it back then, but you didn't know how you're going to get it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. With my Chevelle, definitely. Because my Chevelle, I have a 1970s black with the white stripes, the tuxedo Chevelle.
Sure.
And when I was a kid. What's that?
You got the cowl induction on the hood? Yeah, LS6.
Well, it actually is a 454 under the hood, and Casey Colvin.
Sure.
Colvin, you know,
I know Casey.
Casey.
Sure.
He's the man.
Big Viper guy, yeah.
Fucking love that dude.
Yeah.
He hooked up the cowl so that the ignition
Those vacuum hoses that get old and crack. And
when I was a kid, when I was about 16 years old, one of my friends picked me up. His friend had a 1970 Chevelle, and we were going somewhere. And I just remember getting in the backseat of the car going, how is it possible that this kid owns this car?
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
It was the best-looking car I'd ever seen in my life.
On those 70 series tires, and guys used to back in the day when I had a 69 Olds 442 convertible. And if you didn't have the posi rear end, you'd have the one tire fryer. You know, so you do the burnout, and you got like one stripe going about 400 feet down the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those old cars suck to drive, though. Oh, my God. If you drive the old ones that don't have resto mod components, like roaster shop components, they're just terrible.
Yeah.
They're so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I saw my wife for my 60th last year, my 60th birthday. She and the kids bought me a nice 69 Olds 442. So it's nice enough to where I'll drive it, but not so nice that I don't want to drive it.
Right.
And I just, man, when I drive that thing, it's the slowest, least powerful thing in the fleet. But it just kind of brings me back. I got this jam box I put in the backseat, the turtle box. And I just turn on my AC/DC and go out cruising around. And
you don't even bother installing a stereo in it.
And, you know, if it dies at the stop sign or if it, you know, we'll probably put an LT4, an LSA in it. You know, we'll LS swap it at some point. But
yeah. Do you think you'll do something to the chassis?
It would probably need that. But, you know, I like a scary ride. That kind of it entertains me, you know. So maybe to some degree. We do want to have a balanced, safe car. But, you know, the old saying, Bob Lutz, who used to be the president of Chrysler back in the day when I first met him, he was working for BMW in Germany. He had a pretty fast motorcycle and he's out tooling around Germany and some dude just rips past him on the Autobahn and he pulls into the gas station. It's this old guy and Bob goes up looking at his bike and it's like, is that a turbocharger on your bike? This is like the early 70s. And the German guy says, yes, young man, it has a turbocharger. And Bob says, well, how much horsepower does that bike have? He says, well, probably 200 of the tire. And Bob's like, what, 200 of the tire? He's like, isn't that too much horse? Bob is saying to this old German guy, isn't that too much horsepower? And the old guy looks at him and says, young man, there's no such thing as too much horsepower. Bob told me that story like 30 years ago. I was visiting him up in Detroit. And I think to some degree that's true. But
that's a good
you want to have it
story.
Balanced, you want to have it safe, you know.
As long as you're not there for the end.
As long as you're not in the ditch.
As long as you're not there for the accident.
Right.
The thing about motorcycles is the consequences are so grave.
Well, sure, yeah. I've had a few. I busted up my knee and spent a week in the hospital when I was in high school. And I guess now the term they use, and it's to some degree true, donor cycle. So
yeah.
My boys all like to ride. We ride KTM. We ride dirt bikes up in Colorado in the summertime. But I'm like, on the road, you got to be careful because even back in the day, if you're riding, you know, they're distracted drivers. Now everybody's on their fucking phone. Nobody's paying attention to shit.
So bad.
You know, so.
There's so many people that are just addicted to their phones and they can't put them down while they're driving. It's so wild to see.
Yeah, I mean, every now and then I take a car service to the airport or something. And if you're not driving, you can just like look out the window. Just next time you do that, just look out the window. More than half the people are fucking not even looking at the road. They're on their phone.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to be driving or they're putting on their makeup.
One of the things I love about Apple CarPlay is you don't have to take your hands off of anything.
Absolutely.
You can just say, hey Siri, play.
Yeah.
It'll play a song for you.
Yep.
That is the wild. Like, I do that shit with my daughter because my daughter's into like Taylor Swift and I don't have any Taylor Swift on my phone.
Yeah.
But I could just, while we're in the car, you want to listen to something? And she brings up a song. So I just say, hey Siri, play. And then, bam, like that, it's playing it. I mean,
CarPlay works really well.
It's incredible. The tech, it reads your texts.
Yeah.
It sends texts for you. Yeah. It's fucking amazing.
Did you ever put CarPlay in any of your old cars? They have like retrofit kits now for that kind of stuff.
I have. But honestly, when I'm driving those old cars, I don't like to, sometimes I don't even like to listen to music.
Yeah, I'm the same.
I really
way.
Just want to hear that engine.
Sure, sure.
You know? I listen to the music sometimes, but it always gets annoying. I want to hear that engine. I want to hear that.
Sure. Yeah.
You want to fucking feel that V8.
Yeah. Whoa. Spin the tires a little bit. Not too much.
Yeah. There's something about cars that I guess it was because when I was a kid, it represented freedom, right? Because if you were in high school, if you didn't have a car, you had to ride
freedom,
the bus.
Status.
Yeah. Status for
chicks.
Sure. Chicks for sure.
Friends maybe, you know?
It was really more impressive for guys than it was for girls.
Sure.
The kinds of cars I like, girls are like, this fucking thing stinks.
Yeah.
It smells like gas.
I went to this Jesuit high school up in Kansas City called Rockhurst. And I was a little guy and total nobody. I was on the wrestling team, and I think it was in the 98-pound weight class when I was a freshman. Anyway, I was a total nobody, and then I bought a motorcycle from my dad when I was like a sophomore. And I remember the first time I rolled into school, I was late, and there's like this quadrangle where I could like pull right up to the door, and there's all these windows that are open, and all these guys like rushed to the window to hear what this loud motorcycle was. And all of a sudden, I had status. All of a sudden, I was not a nobody. I was like, who's the wild man in the little kid in the motorcycle?
That is the thing, right? Yeah. If you're a kid showing up at school in a motorcycle, you're a wild man.
Yeah. So same thing that kind of had my car crash.
This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're looking for something to do this summer, you might want to check out some of the upcoming fights. Even better if you can catch them up close in person. It's quite an experience. But if you want to get the best seats, you have to act fast. And that's true for a lot of things in life, especially when it comes to hiring for your business. You need to hire the most talented people you can before the competition scoops them up. And to do that, you need ZipRecruiter. And luckily, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. Got your eye on a rock star candidate? ZipRecruiter's invite to apply feature lets you cut the line. Once you review ZipRecruiter's list of the most qualified candidates for your job, you can easily invite your top choices to apply to encourage them to apply sooner. So, amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan to try it for free right now. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Ash and the guy that lived across the street from me had this old 442 convertible. It's kind of a crazy story. Like, my old man was an insurance adjuster, and he was going to buy this car from this body shop for like a couple $100. And he told me it was going to be my first car, blah, blah, blah. And like a month goes by, I'm like, hey, Dad, when are we getting that car? And he just kind of ignored me and just kind of blew me off. And the next thing I knew, the neighbor across the street had that car.
Wow.
So the tour trip, I didn't get the car, and now I got to drive, go home every day on my motorcycle and look at the neighbor across the street who had the car. So when I had my motorcycle wreck, I had 2 bikes, so 16, and I'm trying to fix my bike, and the guy across the street worked at this Ford factory up in Kansas City, and he offered to help me with the bikes, and I ended up making a deal with him, and I sold him. I traded him the 2 bikes, and I paid him like $50 a month for a year or something like that, and I bought the car back with my own money.
That's awesome.
So I'm like, F you, old man.
That's awesome.
Anyway, it was fun.
Yeah. When you first got into cars, what were the cars? Were you always into American cars, or were you into a lot of foreign cars?
You know, I mean, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I mean, it was all muscle cars. So, you know, you see the guy with the Chevelle or the Camaro, the 70.5 Z28. I'm 60.
Okay. So you're a little older. Born than me. I'm 65.
Yeah. So I just grew up around muscle cars. And then fast forward, you know, went to college for a few years, dropped out, moved from Kansas City to Texas. And back then, like in the 80s, the German cars, they had these rally cars over in Europe. And they call it, there was the Group B rally cars. And they call them the Killer Bees because they got so fast back like in the mid to late 80s that the crowds would like bunch up in the road waiting for these, you know, rally cars blasting by at 120 or whatever. And they knew where the rally cars were because the helicopters were chasing them, you know, kind of spotting for them or the TV camera. And then one time the cars got so fast that they would like hit they got ahead of the helicopters, and these Group B rally cars like landed on people and killed a bunch of people. So they called them the Killer B. So I was really kind of enamored with like the Audi Quattro. They went to Pikes Peak and they raced at Pikes Peak. And that's really kind of what got so I kind of, you know, shifted gears from American muscle to now kind of this higher tech German all-wheel drive turbocharged stuff. And then kind of I started a small environmental cleanup, like an asbestos abatement business back in the late 80s, and made a little bit of money. Wasn't dating my wife, wasn't married yet. And so I read in Motor Trend magazine about this guy named C. Van Toon. He was actually the editor at Motor Trend back in the mid to late 90s. And he had bought an Eagle Talon, this is like 1990, put a roll cage in it, and he goes and enters the Pikes Peak Hill Climb in Colorado Springs. And I read that, and I'm like, oh man, my name's not Andretti or Unser. I can't just show up to Indy, but maybe I could do that. And so made a little bit of money in my asbestos business. I was reading the car magazines, and I'm like, I'm the kind of guy, whether it's then or now, I don't really want to do what everybody else has done. I'm a contrarian by nature, and you know, if everybody else is racing Porsches or whatever. So I'm trying to find something that I can afford, but that's high tech that I can modify to race at Pikes Peak. And I read about a car that came out that year. It was the Mitsubishi 3000 GT VR4. So it was all-wheel drive, twin turbo V6.
Let me see what that looks like.
Four-wheel steer. Yeah. And
I had a Mitsubishi Starion.
Yeah, those are cool. Those are coming back. That's kind of rad woodish.
What that car was? Is it Mitsubishi?
3000. Yeah, just type in Hennessy 3000 GT, and you'll probably see something pop up.
Oh, you know what? Now that I'm thinking about
it,
I had the Dodge version of it.
I had
the Conquest.
Yeah, the Stealth. Oh, the Conquest.
Yeah. Oh, so you had one of those. Those things were sick.
Yeah, those were cool.
I loved those things when I first saw
it. So I took it and raced it at Pikes Peak. and didn't win anything, but
those things were the shit when they came out.
Drove it to Pikes Peak, drove it home. I did a couple races. If you type in, yeah.
You know what's crazy? Does Mitsubishi...
There you go, that Motorton article. There's Bonneville.
Mitsubishi doesn't make anything like that now, right?
You know, Mitsubishi, I mean, a good friend of mine, Joe Jacuzzi, is with GM now. Yeah, there were some really great folks at Mitsubishi, and maybe they've just kind of gone on to other things. But yeah, the VR200. Wow. So that car... So I learned the first rule in car racing. Well, the first rule, if you want to make a small fortune in the car racing business... You start with a larger fortune. and so I'm going and I'm doing these races and I'm going to Pikes Peak and I do these open road races in Nevada where you go out on night. They still have it called the Silver State Classic. They take Highway 318, which is about, just south of Ely, so about 4 hours north of Vegas, and they shut the whole highway down and they let these cars go out on a Sunday morning and go out and haul ass. And so I did, the first time I did it, my average speed for 90 miles was 164 miles an hour. I did 90 miles in 34 minutes in that car.
Jesus Christ.
And, you know, the first time I did it, I didn't even have a roll cage, which is pretty stupid. But after I did all this stuff, so I'm engaged, planning a honeymoon, we bought a house. I like to say we bought furniture, but my wife corrects me on that. We inherited furniture from her family, or I think all I brought to the marriage was a mattress and a box spring and a desk maybe and a Mac. Anyway, so I did all that. I'm doing all these races, come home from the honeymoon, and I look at the bank balance. I'm like, man, I used to have some money in the bank before I got engaged and bought a race car and raced all over the place. And I thought, you know, I really like doing this car thing. Maybe other people would pay me to modify their cars like Carroll Shelby, like Alois Roof with Porsches,
right.
Reeves Callaway. And so October of 1991, we opened up Hennessy Motorsports, and I hired a mechanic and got a toolbox, and off we went. And that kind of led into the JDM market. So
what kind of cars are you modifying back then?
Anything that would roll in the door. And I kind of had a little bit of notoriety from the Silver State race. So, you know, it was JDM, so it was Supras, 300 ZX Twin Turbo, Grand Supra. National, yeah, Supras. So the Mark IV Supra, the Cyclone, the Typhoon,
that had the
3.8 liter single turbo V6. And so then a guy calls me up in early 93 and he said, hey, I've got one of the first Dodge Vipers coming. It was actually a model year 92, but they had some production delays, so the car didn't come out to the spring of 93. And he said, "Hey, I bought a Viper, and I want to take it to the Silver State race, and I want to, if can you help me put like the safety equipment and help it pass tech?" And I said, "Sure." I said, "But I'll make you a deal. If you let me modify it, I think I can get another 100 horsepower to that Viper. And I'll do it for free." I said, "I won't even charge you to do it." I said, "The only thing I'll ask in return, I'll take you out to the race. I'll support you. I'll bring my mechanic. We'll look after your car. After the race, if you'll," again, my buddy Joe Jacuzzi was with Mitsubishi at the time, said, "Hey, I'll take you around L.A. and I'll introduce you to the editor at Motor Trend and Hot Rod and Car Craft and Road and Track." And sure enough, we did all that. And I initially did it with my 3000 GT, got some articles off of it. And I'm like, when I was doing that back in the early 90s, this is before social media, this is before YouTube, no internet. And so that's the only way we knew about car stuff is we did car magazines, right?
Right.
And so I'm doing all this for a couple of weeks with Joe and going around. I'm thinking, man, I've been gone a long time. I did this race. I go to talk to all these media guys. And just like, just be patient. When the magazine comes out, if they like you and they like your car and they write something nice about it, your phone will ring. And sure enough, phone started ringing. So I did all that with the Viper. And then
how'd you get 100 more horsepower out of it?
You know, the Viper is a big, 8 liter V10. And so back in those days, the exhaust system sounded like a UPS truck. They still kind of sound weird. It's 2.5 cylinders basically is what it sounds like. So we freed up the exhaust. We did a cold air intake. We poured and polished the head. So we bumped it to at least 500 horsepower. Then we started doing cams and stroker motors and eventually turbos. And basically from 93 through for the next 10 years into the early 2000s, I would say we were on the covers of 30, 40 magazines, including all the major buff books.
Isn't it crazy when you think about the progression of cars and power that if you go back to the original Viper, it wasn't really that fast?
No, compared to today,
no. What did it have horsepower-wise?
The original was 400, and then they went to 450.
So 400 is like, I mean, you get a regular Mustang GT, you're getting 460.
Yeah, like, yeah. The right new, off the new Dark Horse would be 500, and I mean, right. you could take a a Tesla Model 3 and beat an old Viper. I mean, oh, but yeah. back in the day, but it was so torquey and it was just so outrageous. And
it was
back,
raw.
It was raw. It was
no anti-lock brakes.
That's true. It was kind of scary. We flat spotted a lot of tires. Ooh. But you know, pretty cool car for back in the day. And again, me being the contrarian, there are plenty of other guys out there modifying Corvettes and Mustangs and things like that.
Of course.
I'm the guy that wants to be different. So if you guys are modifying those vehicles, I'm going to modify the Viper. And so that just kind of built up our business kind of grew from just a small tuning shop to a larger scale tuning shop. And then we added it up, well, maybe a year ago. That's from 91 through about a year ago, we had modified about 15,000 vehicles worldwide. Yeah.
Wow.
We did mail order for a while, and some of that was mail order, but last year we modified 564 vehicles last year.
So when did you start getting to the shit you're doing now? Like, you know, you made me a 1,000 horsepower TRX.
Yeah, yeah.
That car is so stupid.
It is. It is so stupid.
But it's so, the problem is.
And the brakes are good? Because I was worried that you would end up into the back of the 18-wheeler.
No, I drive it very responsibly, believe it or not. Okay, I just love the fact that it has so much power.
And it sounds great.
It sounds amazing. Yeah. And it's very comfortable.
Yeah.
And it also, because it's high up, you get a great vantage point. You get to see accidents before they happen.
If you're stuck in the highway and there's some wreck, you can just go through the grass and go into the feeder road.
Yeah, you really could do
that. The other thing is like when I'm driving like my older cars, like I've got a Cadillac CTSV wagon manual, and I'm pulling out of a store and some lady at Christmas a couple years ago runs into me because she didn't see me. So I do like driving something bigger like that because if they run into you, it's not going to do that much, and they generally see you and want to not run into you. So.
My Land Cruiser, well, the TRX has steel bumpers too.
Yeah.
My Land Cruiser also has rock sliders on the side of it. And so because it's lifted, if someone's going to T-bone me, they're going right into the rock slider.
Yeah, it's
going
to be worse for them than it is for you for sure.
It's just, there's so many fucking bad drivers out there.
We could talk at length about that, but I think a lot of that boils down to, like, if you look at Europe, you look at Germany, getting a driver's license in Germany is a serious deal. It takes 2 years.
Really?
It costs about $2,500.
Really?
Getting your driver's license in Germany, Germans are so serious, and they're serious about their cars and about their driving and about the Autobahn, but getting the driver's license in Germany is similar to like getting a private pilot's license over here.
Wow.
Yeah, and so... So why don't we do that over here? Well, that would be a higher barrier for a lot of people. And so, you know, car companies want to sell cars. Insurance companies want to sell insurance.
Also, like maybe people don't need to learn how to drive that good. They just need to pay attention and don't go fast.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't know if it's speed, but it's just paying attention. You know, I mean, our kids all just, in the last 10 years all went through driver's ed. And I think they got, some decent training, but... You know, to your point, like lane discipline, like, if you're the slowest guy out there, get in the right lane.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going a little bit faster, you go in the inside lane. But just that, that drives any serious driver crazy is when somebody's in the left lane going 49. Yeah.
That doesn't bother me.
Okay.
It does bother me, but it doesn't bother me like not paying attention. The not paying attention thing.
The distracted drivers.
It's wild.
Yeah. Well, I would put some of that on the OEMs. I think the OEMs to some degree try to make the cars like nannies, like whether it's autopilot or adaptive steering. I think I had a friend of mine's dad when I was in high school. I'll never forget. He said, "Hey kid, if you want to stay alive, if you're driving at night, don't use your cruise control." I'm like, "Well, why not?" "Well, you set your cruise control, you got your tunes going, you're a little tired, you fall asleep, you end up in the ditch," right?
Yeah.
So I think that, I would almost say that to some degree that the nannies to try to protect drivers all of a sudden become, well, maybe I can crawl in the back seat and take a nap,
Here's a tip for anybody that might be driving and you're worried you're going to fall asleep. Bring a washcloth with you and ice cubes. Like get a wet washcloth and then put ice cubes in that washcloth and just rub your face.
Okay.
It'll keep you awake
the
whole time. It's not painful. I used to slap myself in the face. That's what I used to do.
So you'd be out on a road trip and trying to drive through the night.
Because,
I've done all that.
It's because I was doing stand-up comedy at night and I was delivering newspapers in the morning. So I was always fucking tired.
We've got a lot of things
to deliver newspapers?
Oh, fuck yeah, I did.
I
was 12 years old, Kansas City Star.
Nice.
And dude, I mean, I'm getting up at 3:45, 4 a.m., delivering papers for 2.5 hours. And dude, like on a Sunday, which
is. You do it on your bike?
No, I'm in the back of this paper truck. And this guy had the route, and then, we would have to, roll the paper and put in this machine and crank this thing. It would tie a little knot with some string around it. and fucking toss it out the window when we're going by it. You know, like dogs are barking at you and it's snowing and it's cold. And then I'd be the, I would do some of that, but all of a sudden there'd be like an apartment complex. Well, here's your stack of papers and I'm out tossing them on people's doorsteps. And like on like a juicy day, we might make like $3.25. And so what would we do? We'd go to 7-Eleven and we blow half the cash on freaking, you know, nasty burritos and big gulps and crap like that, you know? But that was just kind of what we did. But that's, I mean, that's what we had to do to make, so you're doing papers while you're doing stand-up.
Yeah, I was doing newspapers from the time, I guess I was probably like 17 or 18 when I first started it.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a little, yeah, somewhere in that range. And I did it for the Boston Herald. Okay. I did it for the Boston Globe. And I did it for the New York Times.
Nice.
And so I had, at one point down, I had a huge route. And I even got a van. I had like a cargo van.
So you were, you had your own deal. You weren't working for somebody else.
No, I was working for a dispatch.
Okay.
So you would get a job working for the Globe.
Okay.
And you'd go to the dispatch and they'd give you a route. Like, yeah. So they give you a map and all the houses that are on it, all the addresses.
Right.
And then they would give you stacks of newspapers. And you had to fold them while you're driving.
Yeah.
So you're driving, you pull up in front of the house. I had a stack of papers right next to me.
Yeah.
And I would just go like this, grab it, zap, zap, whoop, and I had these plastic bags that were hanging from my rear view mirror.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd go, whoa, whoa, wham, and then chuck it out the window.
Yeah, I think we started going to the plastic. So I did it from, I was probably 12 to maybe 14, and then one of my relatives was in a hospital in South Kansas City, St. Joe's, and I found out that they did not have a paper route in the hospital, and I was able to kind of get that. I was able to get that franchise. And I was making, like, back in the day, maybe $80 a week, which is pretty good money back then.
Yeah, I was doing so many newspapers that I actually was – that was the primary money that I was making.
Yeah.
So this was when I wasn't really making much money teaching. And
you were a teacher too?
No, I used to teach martial arts.
Okay, yeah.
So I actually used to teach at Boston University.
Okay.
It was actually a pass fail A, so it counted towards your GPA.
Okay.
So I would tell everybody, if you just try, you'll get an A, and it's a real A. So just try. Just show up and try.
I like your story when those guys were following you and fucking with you, and you're like, hey, you want to come up to the dojo?
Oh, that was hilarious. That was so dumb.
You want to get your ass whipped? Come on.
It was hilarious because they just kept saying that I needed to give them money. And then I said, where are you going? I'm like, I'm going to go teach class.
Yeah.
You want to come up and watch?
Yeah, right. You want to come be there?
And like they're standing there in front of the Jae-Hun Kim Taekwondo Institute, and they're looking at me. They're like, you're teaching? I go, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm a black belt. I'm teaching class. Right. I'll fucking kill you, man. Leave me alone.
You want a few broken
don't
ribs?
Make me kill you.
Exactly.
It was so funny. It was like the least nervous I've ever been, like as a young man.
Yeah.
It was like the perfect, like, it was like the whole reason why I got into fighting at all is because I was terrified of being bullied.
Yeah.
And so to have this moment happen while I'm walking on the street and these two guys start fucking with me and I'm not rattled at all.
Yeah.
And then I get to that door. tell them.
I saw the video. I just laughed my ass off. That was awesome. So when you were doing, you started off in MMA or you started off in jiu-jitsu.
I started off in Taekwondo.
Taekwondo.
Yeah. Well, I started off in karate first. Okay. I went to Esposito's Karate Academy, which was in Newton, Massachusetts, where I lived.
Yeah.
But it was hard to get there. I didn't have a car, and it was like you had to take buses. It was a grind to get there, but Boston was pretty easy. I just had to walk to the T, which was like I had to walk a mile and a half or something like that.
Right.
And then I would get to the T, which was the train that would take me right into Kenmore Square, which is right where the school was.
Now,
so it was
from easy the time you started to the time you felt like you had some skills or a little bit of confidence, how long did that take? 6 months?
Well, I was obsessed. I mean, when I started, when I was 15, I was there every day.
Okay.
I mean, every day. Yeah, I didn't take any days off.
Right.
I was obsessed, and I became a black belt in 2 years.
No shit. Wow.
Yeah, I was teaching like almost right away. Like right after, I think when I got my blue belt, I started teaching private lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Like for the new beginners, I teach them form and stances and how to get your hips into things. And, and I was just teaching them like basics.
Right.
And that helped me a lot because there's something about teaching that like really sort of accelerates your own learning curve.
Interesting.
And so I was obsessed with it. And I was competing already. I started competing like right away when I was white belt.
So you're what, 16? 15?
15. Okay. 15.
All right.
And so, you know, they would take you to these tournaments. Like, so all you had to do is like be at the school and everybody would sort of carpool. And then when I was a kid, it was like they would kind of take care of me.
Yeah.
And bring me to these places.
Right.
And you're in this fucking gymnasium, and there's this other dude across from you, and you're about to try to kick each other unconscious.
Right. Like,
this is wild.
Yeah.
And I became obsessed with it because it was so insane.
Yeah.
It was like to go from like regular life,
right,
you know, just being a kid. I like to draw. I was an artist.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, I'm like traveling around the country,
right,
fighting.
Yeah.
It was so nerve-wracking and so hard to do. It was so challenging. It was such a freak out to do it, and I became so obsessed with it.
Did you have an instructor that like really like invested into you?
And... Yes, yeah. I had several,
uh-huh.
But this guy Michael O'Malley in particular,
yeah.
And this guy Jae-Hun Kim, who is the he's the head instructor of the institute.
Uh-huh.
And he was like a very famous Taekwondo instructor. Like,
yeah.
I got very, very lucky.
Wow.
When I went to that place in 19, whatever, 80, whatever it was,
sure.
81 or 82, when I first went there, it was one of the best schools in the world.
Okay.
It just, I fortunately walked
wow.
in that door. Just
random.
I could have walked into a bad karate school. I wouldn't have known the difference. I was
sure.
15. What the fuck
right.
would I know? But I happened to go, I walked up, I was actually leaving a baseball game and I was going, I've told the story. I'm sorry if people have heard it before. But I was going home and there's a long line to get to the tee. Because everybody was leaving Fenway Park.
Yeah.
And so we walked by the school, and I said, let's go up and see what the fuck's going on up here. Mm-hmm. And we walked up the stairs, and as I was walking up the stairs, I kept hearing this sound, like, whoop,
whoop,
whoop. And it was this guy, John Lee, who became a mentor of mine.
Okay.
And he was a national champion at the time, and he was training for the World Cup. And I think he was 27 or 28 years old. So he was in his absolute prime. And I got to see this guy kick the bag. And I couldn't believe it. It was the force that he was generating.
Well, that's you. That's you now. Like, I mean, I've seen videos. I haven't seen you
that's
train in person.
It. I learned
but I'm
from
like,
him.
It's like, you know, one whack of your leg and you got some broken ribs.
Yeah, but I learned it from that guy.
Wow.
I mean, I learned it from, I mean, he most certainly helped me many, many, many times. But watching him, I learned it from. I mean, I learned it that was possible. Like, I'd never known that a person could do that. Like,
right.
the amount of force. I was like, that is insane.
So you were doing that and you were doing toss newspapers around the same time.
Yes.
Because so newspapers was your income source, but
right.
but fighting was your passion and
yeah.
and cost some money
it
for travel
a,
or
it
whatever.
It was a good way once I got out of high school. It was a good way to generate some money while I was doing this crazy thing where I was trying to make the Olympic team for Taekwondo.
Really? Okay. Huh.
Yeah, so I was competing. I won the Massachusetts State Championship like 4 years in a row.
Okay.
And I was competing in the Nationals, and I couldn't win the Nationals. I came close a couple of times, and I got in the finals of the U.S. Cup with this guy, Kareem Jabbar, who was the national champion. It was a very disputed, close decision that I thought I could have got. But so I was at that level. I was like right close. But unfortunately, then I started kickboxing.
Okay.
And when I started kickboxing, immediately I realized how helpless I was against someone who had really, really good hands. I was
right.
getting fucked up kickboxing.
Okay.
And then I kind of lost my faith in Taekwondo because I realized how limited it was because they don't punch to the face.
Okay.
So you get like you get the most amazing leg dexterity
right.
because you're learning how to – primarily learning how to kick. They have some of the best kicks. But you're so limited in your ability to defend your face from punches.
Because okay.
when punches and kicks are thrown together to your face, it makes things so much more complex.
Right.
And when I was learning that, I lost like some of my faith in Taekwondo.
Wow.
So I had a few kickboxing fights. And then I was doing stand-up at the same time. And I knew I had to pick one or the other.
Now, where did stand-up come into that whole program? How old were you when you started with that?
Well, I was thinking about it when I was like 19 or 20.
Okay.
And
you wrote your own stuff?
Yeah,
okay.
yeah, just like it was horrible.
Right, yeah.
but it was
but you're the kind of guy that like you don't mind you'll put your balls out there and you won't mind getting punished for something you want to try.
Well, I was just curious. Like I'd seen this is what it was. I have a very good friend to this day. His name's Steve Graham. He's a good okay. buddy of mine. And Steve, when I was 15 when I met him, he was an ophthalmologist. And like he'd been on the U.S. ski team, like a fucking a wild man, just
yeah.
done a lot of stuff, like super, super duper smart.
Right.
And, you know, he was like in his 30s and I was like 15 and we used to train together all the time. And when we would go and fight in tournaments, I was the guy who made everybody laugh because everybody would be nervous. We would be all scared because we're going to go fight.
Yeah.
Or when we're about to spar, everyone would be super nervous. Right. Sparring was scary.
Yeah,
you know?
And
I was the guy who like
you cracked, could cut up and crack jokes.
Because I realized that there was like tension in the room and that I could get attention from cracking that tension.
All right.
I could get attention from like making everybody laugh. And so I would do like impressions of guys we knew having sex and like just stupid shit. And it was so dumb. But Steve is the one who told me. Steve and this other guy, Ed Shorter.
Wow.
Who's a friend of mine too. He just said, you really should be, you should do stand up. Like you could do it. I'm like, dude, you think I'm funny because you know me. I'm like, other people are going to think I'm an asshole. Like my sense of humor is so fucked up. But so then that's I went to an open mic night. And when you go to open mic night, one of the things that's good about open mic nights is like if you compare yourself to like Bill Burr or Dave Chappelle, it's like it'll blow your mind.
Yeah,
you won't
be able,
you can't imagine ever reaching that level.
Yeah, right.
But if you go to an open mic night, you realize, oh, these people are terrible.
Yeah.
It's like, so I might suck that bad. Everybody's terrible when they first start.
That's funny.
Me included. I was terrible. And so when you're around these terrible comedians, you realize like, oh, okay. This is how it works. Like, and then when I was at an open mic night the first time, a couple of like real top level pros stopped by and did sets. Like this guy Teddy Bergeron, who did the Tonight Show back in the day, and he was like,
he had some
substance abuse problems. Mm-hmm. But I am telling you, in 1988, there was no one was better. There was people that are at that level, but no one was. He was so smooth and so polished, and his material was so interesting and funny. And I remember I had done my stupid little set. I barely got a few laughs, right? And then I was like, maybe I could do this. Maybe I could do this. And then I went out and watched that guy. I was like, I should just quit now. He went up and just, it was so polished.
Yeah, yeah,
he was in such like ease on stage.
But he'd done it 1,000 times.
Oh,
right?
1,000 times. Yeah. So this was when he was in his prime.
Right, right.
He had one of the best sets I've ever seen on the Tonight Show. He was incredible, but then he went off the rails. He went off the rails and, you know, he just he had some problems.
So did you like learn how to deal with hecklers early on?
Oh yeah, you always have to learn how to deal with hecklers.
Yeah.
You're gonna learn.
Yeah.
You're gonna have some moments where you fall apart. You're gonna have some moments where it works out great.
Yeah.
You know, it's a long, bloody process.
Right.
I compare it to like trying to build a mountain one layer of paint at a time.
Oh shit.
It takes so long. It's so brutal. But it was a way that I could like exist in the world that wasn't a regular job. Like I was whatever it is, it's ADD or whatever the fuck I had. I just couldn't sit still and I couldn't be involved in anything that didn't freak me out. I only wanted to be involved in things that scared me.
So you're the original Fear Factor then. You they cast you for a reason in that deal.
They cast me against a couple of the producers didn't want to cast me because I was making fun of it.
Right.
I went in and when I did the audition for it, they wanted it to be scary. Like, fear is not a factor for you.
Right.
Like, they were interviewing, like, sportscaster type dudes, too. And I went in there, and, you know, I thought, like, I had a deal with NBC. And I think it was to do a sitcom. I'm pretty sure it was. And so I went in to talk to them, and they said, we have this thing.
Yeah.
I was like, what are you doing? And they're like, well, we want to present it to you. So I go there, and like, they're sick of dogs.
We're
going
to put you in a cage with a bunch of centipedes.
Was it originally a show in Holland?
Okay.
It was called Now or Neverland.
Okay.
I think that was what it was called. And so this company bought it, and then they put it on TV in America, and they needed a host. And then, you know, they came to me.
Yeah.
And I was making so much fun because I was high. I showed up high. I was like, I'm going to have this meeting with all these Hollywood people. I always get weirded out by those meetings.
Right.
So I like to show up high.
Uh-huh.
Just to feel them out, you know?
Good.
And I was just making fun of it. Like, you're going to stick dogs on people on TV?
That
like,
is funny.
So stupid. I was like, how long before this gets canceled? I was, like, making all these jokes about like how ridiculous it is you're gonna
so how so you
people.
Were doing the stand-up in Boston, and then what made you think to move to, like, did you go on the road up in
New
the
York.
Northeast?
Okay, I moved New York. To New York okay. first, and that was in the very early 90s.
Okay.
I met a manager who's still my manager to this day.
That's
when
great.
I was an open micer in Boston, and then he moved me out to New York.
Okay.
So I lived in New York for a few years, then I got a development deal to do a sitcom, then I came out to Hollywood.
Okay.
Yeah, but the whole time playing pool.
Yeah.
Like, you and I played pool before. Yeah. You play good pool, dude. You play good
pool. I'm rusty, but you're...
No, yeah, but you know what
you're
doing.
Good motivator for me.
You know what you're doing. Like, I watch you hit the ball. You know what you're doing.
It was fun.
Yeah.
Kind of bring back some memories.
You know how to play pool. Like, some people just play pool. They're just knocking balls around, but I'm watching you get out, and I'm like, okay, you know how to play pool. It's complicated.
We'll see. It is complicated. You got a tough table, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, those tight pockets.
Yeah.
Little snooker table.
Difficult shit.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, what Kennedy say, we don't do these things because they're easy. We do them because they're hard.
Do them because they are hard.
Hard.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
So when I moved to L.A., like, I fucking hated it. But I could go to Hard Times.
Yeah.
And that was, to me, like, there was two places that were
so those were, like, Comedy Club?
LA.
Okay.
No. Comedy Store was the mecca for stand-up, but Hard Times was the mecca for pool. Hard Times.
Really?
Oh, yeah. That's where Keith McCready came from.
Oh, yeah,
Hard Times was this place in Bellflower, and you'd go down there, and I would compete in the Sunday tournament. I mean, I never came close to winning it, but I would get in it all the time and get my nut shot in. But you could play Rodolfo Luat. You could play Efren Reyes.
Really?
You could play Max Eberly.
How cool.
You could play John Mora. You could play just stone cold killers in an open tournament.
Wow.
You could play Efren Reyes.
Wow.
Like, it's just a random draw.
Yeah.
So you go in there, and then, you know, there's a field of, I don't know how many players before it fills up. It fills up every weekend.
Right.
And we would go there on Sunday. You get there early. I played Oscar Dominguez, or I played his dad, Ernesto Dominguez.
Okay. Like,
killer.
This
is like killer. Mauro Paez. These guys were killers. And you would go there and watch literally the best pool in the world.
Wow.
All in Bellflower, California. And there was a lot of gambling matches.
Sweat. Sure.
It was awesome. I loved that place.
Yeah.
So that was like one of the things that saved me.
Okay.
That and going to, there's a few other places that I went. House of Billiards in Sherman Oaks is a great place.
Okay.
We used to play pool there. Hollywood Billiards in Hollywood.
I played
was a
there.
Good spot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that went under.
Yeah.
So, like, that kept me going.
Right. Were you still doing MMA then?
Well, I was doing martial arts. Yeah, I was doing jiu-jitsu.
Oh, that's right, martial arts. Yeah. Okay, got it.
Yeah, that was when I really got into jiu-jitsu. I got into jiu-jitsu in, like, 96.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I was actually at the same gym that Vitor Belfort, when he was making his debut in the UFC, I was training at his gym.
Okay.
Because it was Carlson Gracie's Academy, which was in Hollywood, and I was learning from his coaches.
Okay.
It was crazy, like, to watch Vitor.
Now, how did you connect with UFC and Dana White?
Back then, so when Vitor was making his debut.
Right.
Campbell McLaren.
So this was like late 90s?
97.
97, okay.
So Campbell McLaren, who was one of the producers of the UFC, it was a good friend of my manager.
Okay.
And they were just having a conversation.
Wow.
And he said, hey, you know, just, he was, you know, randomly talking to him about, I got to hire a new guy to do interviews. We need someone to do interviews. And my manager said, Joe is obsessed. Like, he watches them all. Like, he's really obsessed with it.
Yeah.
Maybe he would do it. And so they get us on the phone. I'm like, fuck yeah, I'll do it. And like, you got to take a propeller plane to, like, Dothan, Alabama. I'm like, I'm in. Let's go. And so next thing you know, I'm on these fucking puddle jumper planes flying to all these weird, because it was totally illegal
and this was
in most states.
Yeah, this was like
97.
They had that, like, those, I think, what, Dana bought it from the guys that did the
tough man,
the whole thing in the bar where they beat the crap out of each other in the parking lot.
This was before Dana owned it. This is Bob Meyerowitz.
Oh, really?
I worked for SEG, which was the original company.
This was long before the Fertitta brothers came along with Dana and all that. Okay.
That's how I got back into it. I quit. I did it for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. I did backstage interviews. And then there was an event in Japan. I'm like, I'm not going to Japan. I don't have any time. It was it was literally costing me money.
Okay.
Like, I loved doing it, but I could make more money doing a comedy club on the weekend than I could going.
They weren't making any money, so how are they going to pay you any money, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There was no money to be made.
Right.
There was no money for the fighters. I mean, I wasn't getting screwed. It was just, that's all it was. Like, we would go to these, like, half-filled high school auditoriums. Like, there was no one.
Because a lot of states were banning it and stuff
100%.
Like that back then?
Yeah, it was very hard to get sanctioned.
Right.
That's why we had to go to, like, Dothan, Alabama.
Right.
We had to go, it got banned in New York, actually. My first event was supposed to be in New York, but they banned it in New York right before they did the event, and they moved the event very quickly, like, overnight to Dothan, Alabama.
Were the boxing promoters trying to shut it down?
Yes, 100%.
Okay.
100%.
Okay.
And there was also, there was a lot of, there's so much shenanigans that goes on. There's unions, there's,
if you're not paying them, they're not going to
100%
let you play.
That's how the UFC stayed out of New York State forever.
Okay.
The UFC just got in New York legally. God, how many years ago was it? It wasn't that long ago.
Wow.
Like crazy recent. Really? Yeah, crazy recent. It doesn't make any sense. It was in every other state it was legal.
2015, 16, wasn't that?
Somewhere around then, right?
Wow.
Let's see what the actual...
I never thought about the politics of it till we were just chatting, but I'm like...
Well, back then it was like, it was scary. Like, what is this? No one knew what it was. You didn't have all these years and years of guys like Royce Gracie and George St. Pierre and Kamaru Usman. We didn't have anything to draw from. Mm-hmm. 2016, which is so crazy. New York... The last state to approve it. New York.
That's crazy.
Because they're dirty.
Politics.
The guy who was holding it back, I believe he got arrested for corruption. See if that's true.
Wow.
There was a senator that he got busted for some shenanigans, but he was part of the problem holding it back.
Right.
But in the beginning, I could see why they would hold it back. Like, you're watching these guys headbutt each other.
Right.
They could
kick
in the nuts.
Well, I remember just seeing all the blood and everything. And
crazy.
Remember they used to do the foot stomping and all that?
Well, foot stomping's still legal.
Oh, they could do that? Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
But what you would see back then was like nut shots. You were allowed to punch people in the nuts.
Wow. Brutal. I mean, straight up street fight.
There's a fight with Keith Hackney and Joe Son, and Keith Hackney is on top of Joe Son. And Joe Son's like cranking on his neck, and Keith Hackney's just punching him in the nuts.
He's wearing a cup.
Yeah, but even so, like, whatever.
Yeah, right.
You're still getting punched in the nuts.
Yeah,
even
right.
if you have a cup on, it hurts like hell.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, back in those days, I kind of understand why someone who didn't understand what was going on would think this should be illegal.
Yeah.
I totally get it.
Right.
And it was like they had to develop rules. So they developed weight classes, and then they developed rules. But I was kind of already on the way out by then. And so in 98-ish, 99, I quit.
Okay.
And then the UFC got purchased by Zuffa.
Okay.
And that was in like 2001. And I went to one of their first events.
Okay.
Vladimir Matyushenko fought Tito Ortiz, and it was right after September 11th.
Okay.
And Tito Ortiz, they used to have these elaborate walk-ins with like lights and fire and shit. And Tito Ortiz is walking into the octagon with an American flag. And the place goes wild.
Wow.
Just wild.
That's cool.
Because it was like right after September 11th.
Sure.
It was like, holy shit.
People needed a break from all of that serious stuff.
And during that fight, the pay-per-view went out. And like the people didn't get to see the last rounds of the main event.
Oh, no.
It was a huge disaster. The UFC had to give back who knows how much money. Because it was like their big event in Vegas. And the pay-per-view fucked up.
So Dana bought it yet at this point?
It was the Zuffa, which was the Fertitta brothers and Dana.
Okay.
They're the organization that
I
bought
see.
It. So the Fertitta brothers bought it.
Right.
And then Dana was running it. And this was the very early stages. And this was, you know, there was no TV to speak of that was showing the UFC.
Right.
They had to get this deal on Spike TV to put it on television.
Right, right, right.
That was like years in. So this is like 2005.
Okay.
So we're like 4 years later. These guys are hemorrhaging money trying to make this thing happen.
Yeah.
And when that was going on, nobody took it seriously. Like, everybody thought it was just like...
Isn't that when they came up with the idea of Ultimate Fighter? Is that kind of maybe what turned
exactly
the corner for them?
They paid for everything. They paid to put the show on. I think they even bought out the ads. And they took care of the whole thing. They put it on television. It was like a Hail Mary. And it was a fucking touchdown.
Wow.
And Stephen Bonner... rest in peace, he just died.
Okay.
And Forrest Griffin had the most insane fight in the finals of The Ultimate Fighter.
Wow.
And people were just calling friends up. You got to watch this. This is insane because the viewership skyrockets during the fight.
Yeah, sure.
Because it's so wild.
Right.
And that fight made the UFC. That fight made the sport.
Really?
Because then people are like, what is this?
Okay.
And then they put on another event.
Yeah.
And the other event got fucking huge. And then Chuck Liddell came out to the scene. And when Chuck Liddell was the champion, Chuck Liddell was so fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
He was this do or die berserker. He would just come at you, just swinging bombs, take one on the chin, knock dudes out. His fights were wild.
He didn't give a shit.
He was the real reason why the UFC became uber popular, because you would watch The Ultimate Fighter, and it was a wild fight, a great fight, but then you need a destroyer.
Right.
You need a destroyer, and that destroyer was Chuck Liddell. And for the run where he was at the top, where Chuck Liddell was just murking people.
So he was kind of like the Michael Jordan in that he basically took the sport to another level.
No, well, you know, he was an exceptional champion.
Okay.
But I wouldn't say he was the Michael Jordan.
Okay,
he was just
fair enough.
He had the most fan-friendly style you could ever imagine. He would just come after dudes and smash people. Like, he was never trying to win decisions. Chuck Liddell was trying to send you into the dream world.
Okay.
And that
so he was
became
he was
the
entertainer.
UFC.
He was Maximus the
when
Gladiator.
He would win, he would throw his arms back this. Rah! It was crazy. see if you get a video of Chuck Liddell knocking someone out and then celebrating, because it was like this iconic primal rage celebration. And when you know, you can only fight like that for so long.
Sure.
Here's the reality.
It's gonna take the toll
of physical damage on the body and the kind of sparring that you have to do to fight like that.
Yeah.
But when he did it, my God, it was glorious. His fights, when he knocked out Tito Ortiz, like, oh my God, he was a monster.
Right.
He was a monster.
Yeah.
He was just smashing people. And he was a really good wrestler, too. So good luck taking him down.
Wow.
You know? So this is, I mean, this is Chuck with a fucking mohawk.
Yeah,
I mean, look
mohawk.
At this fucking savage, dude.
Oh my God.
Look at this. Watch this. Yeah. Look at this. Look at him. Oh,
like
they're not showing
bull.
The cell. Look at him. Look at his celebration. Bro,
wow.
I'm telling you, when Chuck Liddell was in his prime, he was one of the most terrifying fucking human beings that's ever walked the face of the earth.
Wow.
You can't do this for that long. There's only so many years a man can do this for like this. But my God, Chuck Liddell was so fucking entertaining. He was a destroyer, man. He would just come at you. I mean, look at this shit. He's so terrifying looking. Tattoo on his head, mohawk, built like a brick shit house, just throwing fucking hammers.
Who's the destroyer? Who's the up and coming destroyer today?
Oh, did you see that Babalu knockout? Back that up again. This one was insane.
Oh, with the leg?
Dude, he would do that to everybody. He was just
relentless.
Smashing people.
Wow. Yeah, he didn't know what defense is. He's pure offense all the time.
Well, he had defense, but he didn't. He fucking threw caution to the wind, man.
Wow.
The guy just came after people, and he was so mean. But that also made the UFC, because that guy being at, that was the figurehead. That was the big guy. He was the face of the company, because he was the guy that, like, if you, the casual fan, when you talk to him, like, have you seen the Chuck Liddell fight? You're going to see the Chuck Liddell fight.
Yeah.
So that, like, That also took the sport to the next level.
So from throwing newspapers to stand up to pool to New York, then Hollywood, UFC interviews. What motivated you for podcasts? You were so far ahead of your time on that.
Well, I wasn't really. There was other people that were doing it at the same time. They like Adam Carolla already had a podcast.
Yeah.
Mark Maron already had a podcast. There was quite a few people that were already
doing it. Maybe it's your style just stuck and grew.
Well, it's just I think. I got into it because of radio, really.
Okay.
I was like doing like Opie and Anthony show mostly.
Okay.
Like
you did radio for a while then.
Oh yeah, everybody did.
Okay.
And when you would do radio in the morning, like the Opie and Anthony show in particular, you'd go there and you would hang out with comics. So it was all just us shooting the shit, having a great time.
Yeah.
And when I would leave there, I'd go, God, that's so fun. I love doing that. I wish I could do that all the time.
Okay. All right.
And Anthony Cumia, who was Anthony from Opie and Anthony, he built a studio in his basement of his house in Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to do a show called Live from the Compound.
Okay.
And he had like a green screen behind him. He'd play karaoke with a machine gun. he was always hammered. It was hilarious. But he would just stream it on the internet. And I was like, that looks like so much fun. Maybe I should start doing something like that.
Yeah.
And so then I went to Tom Green's house, and Tom Green, he had this crazy setup. I might have went to Tom Green's house before Anthony had his thing, in the same time period.
Yeah.
But Tom Green had like the Tom Green show that he was doing from his house.
Right.
So he's doing like a talk show, and he set up his whole house like a television studio that's on the internet. So we had all these cables running to a server, a server room. And so I thought, like, wow, maybe I should do something like that. Like, there's something to doing something on the internet. Like, maybe a lot of people aren't going to see it, but it'll be fun.
Yeah, sounds
That's
like your motivator was for fun, not trying to grow some big audience or make a bunch of money, at least to start with. I mean,
even, like, I do it the exact same way now as I've always done it. I just do it all myself, in terms of, like, who I want to have on. I decide what day they're coming on and how to do it.
Yeah.
And I only talk to people that I'm interested in talking to.
I mean, the depth of what, like, you could have, like, your own Rogan encyclopedia books, but all these people that come on that a lot of people have never heard of and have all these interesting facts and opinions, and
well,
I find it fascinating.
You definitely learn some stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you definitely, I mean, you could talk to some, I've had this, like, unexpected education where I get to talk to all these fascinating people and pick their brain.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, you don't really get a chance to talk to people just like this. Like,
right.
Just you and me looking at each other eye to eye, no phones, no people around,
right.
Just for a conversation. That's it. That's all
yeah.
We're trying to do. And to be able to do this, like, all the time, it just, it's a real pleasure. It's like very, it's very fortunate.
Well, it just
really
seems like it's
you.
your own personal curiosity on different things that you like and or that you're interested in, whereas it seems like, you know, you flip on TV, the people that get interviewed, it's all part of some sort of a, it's all by design to some degree. You know, you got the
yeah.
right PR firm, the right publicist.
There's also with those things, the problem is, you know, just like with Fear Factor, like you have to hire somebody. You have to hire a host.
Okay, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So if it's Fox News or if it's CNN, they have to hire hosts.
Right.
And sometimes those people are annoying, you know, and sometimes they're not annoying when you
right.
hire them, and then they become annoying as they get more popular and famous.
Right.
And then you got to fire them.
So, like, when you do this, do you have to prep much? You get on the internet, you guys do a little bit of research for you, or you just fucking roll in and just start thinking and talking?
Well, I do have a guy, my friend Matt Staggs, who does some research for me on some things. He'll
yeah.
send me some briefings or some videos or some stuff I should watch.
Right.
And then, you know, with people that have books, I like to, especially if it's something, like, complicated, I like to listen to the book on audio.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll listen in the sauna, I'll listen when I'm driving.
Right.
I'll get a sense of what they're doing. But, and then there's some subjects that I don't have, like with you, it's like, we're going to talk cars, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just curious.
Well, it's just been very fascinating for me. I mean, we've known each other for ever since you got to Texas 2.5 years ago,
yeah,
something like
yeah.
that. Just, you know, the more I get to know you, like,
you ruined me with that fucking Raptor.
Well, yeah, that's what we do, right? Keep them coming back, right?
That thing ruined me. I was like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
What have you done?
Yeah, yeah. Have you, by the way, have you experienced the Raptor R yet?
I have not. It
okay.
looks amazing, though.
They're
I'm
hard
a
to
Ford
get. They're
fan.
Expensive. But we're working on a 1,000 horsepower package for Velociraptor 1000, so it would compete with the Mammoth.
Well,
yeah,
maybe I have to.
Yeah,
I'll
keep you posted on that.
You know what I really miss about the Raptor?
Yeah.
The visibility.
Yeah.
It's way, you can see out of the side mirrors way better.
Yeah.
The TRX is rough.
The TRX is rough. The Ford's got the aluminum body and chassis. I mean, I think both trucks are a hoot.
Oh,
and
no, I love
plenty.
The TRX. It's
yeah.
just the visibility.
Yeah,
That's
yeah.
the only
okay.
issue I have with
uh-huh.
it. It's an amazing
yeah.
truck.
Yeah, yeah.
I fucking love it.
Yeah.
I love what Dodge did, and I really love what you did to what Dodge did. Like the extra power. And
they gave us a good platform. And
the brake upgrade package
yeah, yeah.
that you put on it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a big difference. Big
yeah.
difference. It's fucking magical. I love that thing. But the visibility from the Raptor was way better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
I mean,
design with the F-150 where they
yeah,
have
there
it.
There it is.
There it is. Look
yeah,
at that.
Yeah. And so that's got the supercharged 5.2 liter V8 that's in the GT500. And we should have our prototype up and running soon. I'll set
I like
up
the
your...
name better too.
Yeah.
I have a problem with the name Mammoth.
Okay.
I love the truck, but I got a problem.
What? Tell me.
Because it used to be a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and you changed it into a lesser animal.
Well, I guess yeah. I guess the T Rex could eat a
yeah, you can't have that.
A woolly mammoth. I never thought about it that
yeah.
way.
I wish we talked.
Yes. Well, guess what? Next time we're doing a branding exercise, you'll be the consultant that I could never afford to hire.
You can't. Well, I'll just do it for free. But
okay.
you can't have like a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Like the whole reason why it's a TRX is because it kills the Raptor.
Right.
Of a little bitch ass Velociraptor
yeah,
fucking
sure.
with the Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's
yeah,
over.
Yeah.
So that's the whole idea. And then you turn it into like something that like people kill with sticks.
Yeah. So what?
People let them out with sticks.
Yeah, pretty much. That's
yeah.
funny.
And then probably the asteroid did it
yeah.
too.
But yeah.
yeah. So but other than that, I love it. I told you I saw one in Vegas.
Yeah.
It was orange. Like
yeah,
a
yeah.
matte orange. It's like, oh, that looks
ignition
sick.
Orange, yeah.
I never thought
cool.
I wanted to drive an orange car in my life until
I
saw
know.
That.
They're hard to get, but we can get them. They got yellow now too.
Oh, do they have yellow?
Yeah, yeah. Called wow. Rampage Yellow. Yeah.
My friend Tony has a yellow C8 Corvette.
Uh-huh.
Tony Hinchcliffe.
Yeah.
You saw Tony.
Sure.
He has one with yellow with black stripes.
Uh-huh.
It's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I was like, I never thought I'd like a yellow car.
Yeah. We actually just came out with a 700 horsepower supercharged package for the C8s. We've only been working on it for almost 3 years, but just finished it up a few months ago.
How much better is the handling on the Z06 with the wider body and the wider tires?
Yeah.
And...
I mean, the Z06 is lighter. It's got aero, carbon brakes, carbon wheels are options. I've only driven, so our chief development driver was with GM for 38 years. His name's John Heinrich. We call him Hein Rocket. he's our chief engineer and development driver for the Venom F5. And so he just got his new Z06, C806, with the Z07 package. So you've got the Cup 2 Michelin tires and the carbon splitter and rear wing. And I just drove it on the road. But I think if you took him to COTA, both bone stock, I'm guessing you're 10, 12 seconds a lap difference. I mean, just massive.
Wow.
Now, if you drag race them, of course, the Z06 is going to win by, you know, in the quarter mile would probably win by 5 or 6 car lengths. But the problem with the Z06 now is they've been having supply chain, they still have supply chain issues. I've got an early one on order, but I think the car's been out for 9 months, and there's only about, there's less than 100 with the Z07 package on the road. So, cool car. You know, I hope to get mine and a lot of bang for the buck. I think that that would, I almost liken the new C8 Corvette almost in any form. Well, the Z06 is kind of like the 458 Ferrari is kind of where it was.
Do you think it's possible to make a car like a Corvette with entirely American parts and American labor? Entirely.
Look, American OEMs can do whatever they want to do. And, I think what Chevrolet's magic has been with the Corvette is to deliver that much value and that nice of a car in the volumes that they do and at the price point that they do.
It's crazy. When you think about how much that car costs and the capability of it, just the bone stock Stingray.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure the – so Z06 is out now. Likely the next iteration that comes from Chevy is the ZR1, probably 850 horsepower, twin turbo. So it's like a twin turbo version of the 5.5 liter dual overhead cam motor in this current Z06. That car is going to be 150, 170 grand. So that car will be as fast or faster than a McLaren or Ferrari that costs 2 or 3 times the money. So they, you know, their trick is they know how to deliver great value. Now we've got a neat niche where we can build our own car from the ground up. It's all carbon fiber. It's all completely bespoke. It's American design, American build. But that car is $2 to $3 million a pop. You know, GM are the masters of being able to scale it in masses, so you know, average people or somewhat average working folks can afford to buy them.
Yeah, when you're in that car, you're like, what does this cost?
Yeah,
this car's ridiculous.
Well, the sticker on them, like my friend Heinrock, I think he paid $160. You try to find one on the street that you can buy.
You mean a Z06?
A Z06.
I was talking about the Venom.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah.
You get in that thing. You're like, how much does this cost?
Yeah, yeah. But look, the Venom F5. What's cool about that is I'm 60. Maybe I'm around another 25 years. Maybe I'm not. I don't know. But I think I would like to see. You know, I'd like to have ultimately when we're all done with production, I'd love for each one of my 5 kids to have one if I'm able to do that. Anyway, I'd love to see our grandkids sell it at Barrett Jacks or RM auctions at some point down the road for, 4 or 5X, maybe like a McLaren F1, like it'd be $20 million someday.
I respect that you can drive that on the street.
Sure.
I respect that you can drive it, but you really should drive that only on a track. I mean, it's like when you're in it, you're like,
yeah. Well, even like when we're driving, like driving, if you still have your Tesla Plaid, I drove mine up here, the performance that the thing's capable of, you should not use on the street.
No.
Sometimes there might be a place where, you could go out and just have fun with yourself or your buddy. But same thing. I mean, the F5, forget about 0 to 60. 0 to 60 is a metric from 60 years ago. Let's talk about 0 to 200. It'll go to 0 to 200 miles an hour in 10 seconds, a hair under 10 seconds. It's as fast as, or maybe a tiny bit faster from 0 to 200 miles an hour as compared to a modern Formula One car.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, power to weight ratio wise. So. But it's built in America. Our guys just 100 miles down the road build them from you here, and I think they'll be very collectible someday. So we'll see.
How many are you going to make?
So we built 24 Venom F5 coupes. Those are all sold out. We're now producing the Roadster and the Revolution. The Roadster, open top, go out, sunny day, have fun. The Revolution is more track focused. Now it's like our GT3 RS. It's a track focused car, but it's still road legal. Has AC and all the comforts that you has Apple CarPlay.
More track focused than that car?
No, that is the track focused version. Yeah, so we're doing 24 of those. So we're going to build all in about less than 100 cars, so 99 cars. I think right now we're, like I said, 36, 37 orders. And anyway.
How long does it take you to build one of those?
12 to 15 months.
And is it how much of it is carbon fiber? Like
100%.
100%.
Yeah, I mean all the body work, all the chassis, all carbon.
Everything.
There's some aluminum and some steel substructure, but everything's carbon.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so, there it is. That's the Roadster. That one, that particular, the blue car, dude, belongs to a guy named Dave Liniger. You want to talk about a wild man.
Let me see what the side image looks like, what it looks like with the Roadster. Wow, that's pretty.
Yeah. Liniger founded Remax Real Estate way back when. Anyway, that's his car. That's my head of design, Nathan Malinick. But, you know, this is one of these deals to where if I knew back then what I knew today, I don't know if I would have done it. Maybe I'm a little bit like you walking into the dojo. You ever see those gifts?
How pretty that is.
You ever see the gifts where the guys have the telephone pole and they're busting somebody in the balls with it?
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that, and it, like, I didn't know what I was biting off when I went down this road, but when I started in 2013, it was just kind of an idea and a sketch, and then I got interested in it, and then we built the design model. Shell helped us build a design model, and we unveiled it at SEMA in Vegas in 2017. And then I had orders, and I'm like, now I've got orders. I've got a design, but I've got to engineer this thing.
Dude, that thing looks so good.
It's such a beautiful car.
That Roadster one, that blue one,
yeah.
Oh, my God, that's so beautiful.
Well, and the sound, what did you think
it's
of the
incredible.
Sound when we're just out here ripping down the road?
It's very
raw. Yeah, it's very raw. So it's that 6.6-liter twin-turbo V8, pushrod V8. We've nicknamed the engine Fury. So ask me why we named the engine Fury.
Why?
No journalist has ever asked me this question in the automotive world. So we named it Fury because the car is designed to compete against Europeans, the best from Europe. So Bugatti, Aston Martin, Ferrari, Gordon Murray. And so one time, like, we're developing the engine, and I think we had – our target was 1,600 horsepower. We managed to get a little over 1,800. And I'm watching reruns on TV with my wife. My wife's asleep. And it was a Brad Pitt movie, Fury. So it's those scrappy tank guys. They're over in Germany, and their tank's all busted down. And then here comes 200 or 300 Germans, and they basically fought them to the death, you know, like scrappy Americans that they were. So I thought, I'm going to fucking name my engine Fury because it's designed to go over and fucking beat the Germans. Scrappy American. We'll see.
That's
we
amazing.
Haven't done it yet, but we're working on it.
I love it.
Yeah.
So is that a car that you could enter into races? Like, would you consider racing
that
thing?
We've had customers ask us, Would we be interested in building a dedicated race car? And something we haven't made a decision on, but the answer I lean towards, you know, generally, you know, you want to build a faster car? Well, hell yeah. If somebody wants to buy it, I'll build it. But then the question becomes, we have to kind of go two directions. Do we want to just build a fun, like something, take it to Circuit of the Americas that our customer can go out and have fun with? Or do you want to conform to race series? All of a sudden, if you're in a race series, if you're in Le Mans, you know, something like a World Endurance Championship, you have to conform to all kinds of rules. I'm not a big rule guy. I'd rather just kind of build my car,
kick ass.
But I think there is probably some demand to have a dedicated track car where you've got a full roll cage, all the safety equipment, the Halon fire extinguishing system, and everything else that you would expect. But right now, I mean, we're building, you know, the coupes are sold out. We're completing the remaining run of those. Yeah, there's
Jesus
a revolution right there.
Christ, look at
yeah, that
thing.
Belongs to a guy. We actually went to the same Jesuit high school back in the late 70s. He was a senior, and I was a freshman, and we never knew each other. But when he ordered the car, I found out he was from Kansas City and went to Rockhurst, and he has his own private test track. Just
oh
up outside
God.
Of Kansas City.
That's
yeah,
hilarious.
You're just driving through the country and you see this fence with, like, you know, privacy. And on the other side of it is this gentleman's 3.4-mile private racetrack that we get to test at. It's
that's
cool.
When you know you're really balling.
He's balling pretty good.
You get your own racetrack?
He's done all right. Oil and gas guy and smart guy and been a really, really great client. So
I used to think that when I would watch Top Gear, watch
yeah,
the Stig
sure.
roll around the track.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
like, they have their own track.
Well, yeah, so Top Gear tests on an old runway southwest of Lennon, and it's called Dunsfold.
Hmm.
So they ran it, so they have their own. But they do, I've been there before. I brought Steven Tyler over there like 10 years ago to be interviewed by Jeremy Clarkson and those guys. So he was a client. We built a Venom GT for him, and so we're hanging out, and I got to see him go out and do his little celebrity lap around the truck. You know, if you're ever over there and you want to do a celebrity, the star in the reasonably priced car, I'd connect you with those guys.
Oh,
they're great.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's fun. And so I think they're, but now you got Chris Harris and you got the, you know, Clarkson and Hammond and May. They moved on to Amazon. But
are they still doing it? Or did they
stop
doing it?
Yeah, I was in London a couple weeks ago and I saw Richard Hammond and
what's the Amazon show called again?
The Grand Tour.
Right.
The Grand Tour. And so Clarkson's kind of a wild, bombastic guy. He started a show about farming. He's got a farm out in the country. And I think that's really kind of taken off. So I think that's his new gig. But I think they still do a season a year. And good entertainment, good proper.
Yeah, they're fun.
Proper car stuff.
He's a fun dude.
Yeah.
What did he punch a producer? They pulled the show.
Well, I know a little bit about that. We had a Velociraptor Raptor truck that we were up in Canada with these guys. So this has been back in into 2014. And so like I'm working with the producers and they're like, you know, when you're around the talent, you know, don't talk to them. Don't spend time around them. I'm like, I'm around famous people more than these guys. These guys are a lot more famous. I mean, I don't care that they're a big deal. So anyway, so the producer's kind of being a dick. And so we show up with these guys and then we're like, provide the vehicle. And they're going to go cross country through Canada and through the mountains and do all this crazy shit. And then they're going to go up on the mountain. They're going to rescue Richard Hammond, who's at the top of the mountain. He's got one of these Breitling watches where you pull out the little cord and it tells the satellite that you're stranded. So it gives your coordinates to get rescued. Anyway, so now the producers are saying, well, you know, you can't go up on the mountain while they're filming. I'm like, okay, but listen to this. I'm going to go watch football. It's the playoffs. I'm going to go watch football. And if something breaks and you need us to help you, we're not coming. They're like, oh, then they change their tune. Like, okay, well, come with us. And finally, it all turns out fine. Well, that producer, I won't say his name, but that producer that was being a massive dick, and maybe he was just doing his job. Like 2 weeks later, they're somewhere else, and they're in England. And Jeremy gets a little bit of a temper, and these guys work long hours, and maybe they hadn't eaten. And the producer guy was fucking with him, and Jeremy fucking whacked the guy. And I'm like, I wanted to fucking punch that guy a couple times too. But I can't do that, and I don't want to get arrested in Canada anyway.
Yeah, so they canceled the show.
Yeah.
And didn't Jeremy and him make up, but they're still like...
You know, I'm sure that's all, you know, water under the bridge. But Jeremy, Richard Hammond, and James May were all very tight. I've spent time around them. And then the other guy that's behind the scenes, but just so talented, his name is Andy Willman. He was the producer when they were on BBC. Now he's the producer. But when Steven Tyler was being interviewed, you'll like this from your comedy part of your brain. When Steven was being interviewed by Jeremy, I noticed that the interview went on for like twice as long as it probably should have. And I get claustrophobic, so I don't like being in tight crowds. So I'm kind of hanging towards the back of the crowd that they're filming all this live, and then they aired it later. But they're filming in front of a live audience. And here, this guy that looks like he's a homeless dude wearing a t-shirt, looked like he hadn't showered in about a week. He's standing there making notes. And I realized that was Andy Willman, the producer of the show. And so what Jeremy's doing, he's telling all these jokes and asking these questions. And Andy is using the live audience as his focus group. Oh, they laughed at this. Oh, I don't think this is as funny. And that's how they edit it before it goes, gets transmitted to the rest of the UK and the world.
Interesting.
I thought that is so clever. That is so smart. You know, it is smart. And I don't know if that, you know, comedians or entertainers kind of, but you know, you would think to some degree you want to improve your craft, but he's got a quick turnaround time. So like he's got another show he's got to do the following week. So he's just like, Jeremy is doing all this stuff and sometimes they laugh and sometimes they wouldn't, but this guy was definitely paying attention.
That show, Top Gear, did Tesla dirty. You know,
they did. They did all kinds of crooked shit.
But they did Tesla dirty. I mean, they pretended the car ran out of batteries.
Oh, yeah.
No. And the car didn't. So they had, like, they're pushing the car. And, you know, I think they had a lawsuit about that, correct?
They probably did. But that goes back to, like, what we were talking about earlier.
Find that
out,
Jamie.
Like, it just seems like...
That was dirty.
It seems like everybody has an agenda. So what was the agenda behind that? Was that just the...
Well, they wanted to create an entertaining storyline. They'll
throw your ass under the bus in a heartbeat.
That was what it is.
Yeah.
Oh, Tesla attempted to sue the BBC for libel in March of 2011. The courts ruled in favor of the BBC, saying that no viewer of the show would be likely to reasonably compare the Roadster's performance on the show with its performance in the real world. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, no, they got
railroaded.
You know, British court sides with British corporation that's owned by the British government against American company. Oops.
Yeah, they got railroaded.
Yeah, they
because
did.
Because the idea that watching this thing break down wouldn't influence you to not get one.
Yeah,
like, these people are testing it, and it breaks down. That's...
Look, those guys, good or bad.
We should just say what happened.
Yeah.
While we're saying it.
Yeah.
Because their car didn't really break down.
Right.
They faked it.
No, they faked it.
And
they faked it.
They did it just to sort of make a point about what could happen with electric cars, but it's a fake
point. It was manufactured deal, like to your point. But like you know, they just want eyeballs. You know, so controversial... You know, one time when Jeremy was driving this truck and they were like, what would happen if we ran into a brick wall? he ended up going to the hospital and getting, you know, broken ribs and whatever else. Just shoot the video of this guy. So they'll do anything.
Who ran into a brick wall?
Jeremy Clarkson.
He did?
Yeah.
With a truck?
It's on YouTube.
And he went to the hospital?
Yeah, they got a video camera. They got a GoPro inside. And
he went to the hospital?
Yeah, he went to the hospital from that. And
why would you do that?
They did, and
imagine if he died.
Attention, dude. These guys were the masters of jumping the shark season after season after season. You heard about the deal when they went to Argentina?
What deal? Well, let's go one step at a time. Let me see the truck slamming into the wall.
Yeah.
Before we get to Argentina.
Yeah.
Because I just can't believe that they would just drive a
Clarkson Top Gear
full
crash,
acceleration
truck crash. No, each guy had to do it, and they're all wearing their safety equipment. It might have been 20 miles an hour. I mean, just go, run as fast as you can into that wood wall over there, and it's going to fucking hurt, you know? So.
Yeah, I would think you could, legitimately, you could die.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's here one of go. These trucks?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, look at this. He's going pretty good.
Bro, he's going very fast. That is so crazy.
So do you think these guys give a fuck about hurting Elon and his company?
That
just to try?
Is so crazy.
They want views.
Oh, my God, bro.
I mean,
He got fucking
He's lucky
wrecked.
He has teeth.
He's lucky he has a neck.
Yeah.
Like, his neck's got to be fucked up from that.
Yeah, we did a thing with them at Grand Tour in Detroit about 5 years ago, and, maybe he's got a good chiropractor. He looks like he healed up, but, man, that's pretty gnarly.
That seems like it could cause permanent damage. And so they would do stuff like that.
Well, and that even happened recently.
Slipped discs. Worst injury he suffered on the show.
Another one of their guys in the current crew, I forget his name, maybe Pat O'Rourke, but anyway, he had a bad car crash. They canceled the whole season.
Really?
The rest of the season.
Bad?
Yeah, and again, nobody really knows the details. They're not showing anything, but I hear it was pretty painful. Yeah, so.
Well, you watch that image. He reaches for his neck, like, immediately, and you see how his head violently snaps.
Yeah, I don't know how
it doesn't break
your neck. So just like stuff like that, like when we were in Canada with the crew, and like so they went down to Canada. They weren't They went Argentina. Excuse me, the gummy bears kicking in, I suppose. They're in Argentina, and so in one of the cars they rode on the car. They're doing this cross country thing. They're kind of poking fun at the Argentinians when they lost the Falkland War back in the '80s to the Brits.
Oh my God.
And the story was that these guys were getting chased out of the country. Like, people were going to, like, looking for them. If they found them, they were going to freaking, beat their ass pretty hard or worse. And so I'm talking to the crew, and, the presenters were able to get to Buenos Aires and were able to get out of the country. But the crew was still there. And people are like, they're calling the embassy. They're like, hey, what can we do? The fucking locals are trying to get us. And so I guess this is what I'm hearing from the crew when we were in Canada with our Velociraptor, is that, the presenters got out. The crew were stuck fearing for their lives, like hiding out in places, trying to make it to the airport to get home. And then so when the whole shit hit the fan, the presenters in England felt bad for them, so they bought them all first-class tickets or business class from Argentina back to the UK. But then the question becomes, kind of given the pattern of wanting to further jump the shark, and look, if I climb a mountain, I want to climb the next mountain, so I get that to some degree. But did these guys actually, like, try to stir up the locals by putting shit on their car to fuck with them?
Well, of course they did.
Yeah, just for notoriety. And so, I mean.
Yeah, that's the show.
I would think so. I mean.
100%. Why else would you do it? Because you're trying to be nice?
Yeah. I don't know if they knew it was going to go as far, but man, but it's kind of a shitty deal where they skated out of there and their crew is literally, afraid they were going to get fucking beat to death.
Imagine if they did.
Yeah. So and I'm hearing this from the crew, and this auto had gone down like 30 days before.
Jesus
Christ. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, but,
Well, it's a wild show, but it's a fun show.
They're irreverent, and they fuck with everybody, and, if they've gone too far a few times, sure, but I think they're, just trying to entertain.
Well, he does entertain, and when Jeremy Clarkson reviews cars, it's like when he's really enthusiastic about it, like he's reviewed some Ferraris.
That guy's word was like, it would either make you or break you.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, probably from 05 to 20, Farrow had about a 10-year period. Now you got Chris Harris, who's friends with our mutual friend Matt Farrow out in California.
Yeah, I've had Chris on the podcast before.
Okay, cool.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's probably one of my favorites.
We had dinner with him in London a couple weeks ago, and just could be any finer.
Yeah, him and Matt are two of my favorites.
Yeah,
for reviewing cars.
Yeah,
Smokey Tire's awesome.
Yeah.
It's just car entertainment. You know, has sort of come a long way.
Right.
There wasn't really that much back in the day. I mean,
right.
There was not really a show like once Top Gear came around. Then people realized how entertaining it is just to like see cars and hang out with cars.
Yeah. Right.
Now, I think really one of the best of it is Jay Leno. Like, Jay Leno's garage is fantastic.
It is great.
It's very good.
Yeah.
He loves cars so much that it's like, it's so contagious.
I don't know anybody that knows more about cars from A to Z, from steam cars to hyper cars to race cars, everything in between. Jay Leno is literally a walking automotive encyclopedia.
Yeah, I don't understand the steam cars. Like, get out of here with that.
Well,
what are you doing?
Yeah, it's.
He's got ones that he drives around that aren't even supposed to have rubber tires. So he had to put rubber on these steel wheels so that it's legal to drive around.
Well, did he ever tell you on a steam car, you're heating up this boiler and the boiler's got water in it and that turns into steam and that's what makes it go. But when you run low on water, if you're not careful, it'll explode.
Oh,
so
boy.
you have to turn off the heat and so. So this came up because I was in Jay's one time and I saw one of his steam cars and he's talking about it. I'm like, what's the garden hose in the back seat for? It's like, well, you know, I'm over at driving through Burbank and, you know, his start running out of water. So he's able to shut it down so the engine doesn't explode. And he goes up and knocks on some little old lady's front door and says, you know, ma'am, can I hook my spigot up to your, you know, my hose up to your spigot? I need to put some water in my steam car.
Imagine Jay Leno showing up at your house.
Oh, yeah.
Wanting to borrow water.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's some crazy
shit. Yeah, he's got an insane collection. I can't even believe how big it is. When I was there, I thought it was just one of these buildings.
Yeah.
And it's 11.
Oh, it's the whole block.
He has 11 buildings.
Yeah,
like that.
They're all kind of daisy-chained together.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And motorcycles, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. Jay's been a customer, gosh, almost 30 years. He had the first black Gen 1 Viper. And so he wanted to do an exhaust, an intake, and a 373 rear end gear. And so we're scheduled to go out there. And I just talked to him like on the phone one time. And I only dealt with him. I didn't deal with any assistants or handlers. And so I just dealt with him on the phone the one time. And then my wife had our first child. We had a miscarriage. And so I couldn't go. So I just had somebody call out there to his office, say, John can't make it. Didn't give me any reason. And dude, like, 2 days later, flowers and a card showed up to our house. And to this day, I do not know how Jay knew that we had a miscarriage or even knew my home address, but somehow he found out and sent flowers. We've been friends ever since.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's very
special
nice.
Dude for sure. Super passionate, super influential. You know, another thing I learned from Jay that's cool, so whether it's a $2.7 million Venom F5 Revolution or one of our, you know, Velociraptor Mammoth trucks, whenever I'm out in public with one of our vehicles or if I'm at like a Cars and Coffee car show, Jay taught me that. What got you into cars, Jay? He said, well, when he was 12 years old, there was like maybe a 55 Jag parked out in front of a store and he was admiring it. And the guy came up to the car and says, hey, kid, you like the car? And he says, yeah. And the owner said, would you like to sit in it? And so I've seen Jay at a bunch of car shows. So if you're somewhere south of 12 years old, you know, and you ask him nicely, you know, he'll let you sit in his car. So we do the same thing. And so when they kind of start queuing up and I get the 14-year-old, I'm like, no, we'll have to
He goes to those Cars and Coffees.
Oh, yeah,
right?
No, he's...
Takes all kinds
you know
of shit.
You know what I mean? So when Jay was doing Tonight's Show, that's when I met him. And, you know, we did several projects for him. He'd have us come out to the show. But he was always so busy. Like, I would just, like, see him in passing. And he's so, like, high-functioning, ADHD... dyslexic, which my son Cole is too. It's just like his brain just moves at a million miles a minute. So like I see him, hey Jay, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. In and out, get in his next car and go. But then when he retired from the Tonight Show, a whole different Jay. Just like you could have a conversation with him. He wasn't thinking about all the shit he had to do. And
he's so much better at that show. Because it's so much what he's actually interested
Absolutely.
In instead of just the job of hosting
and,
the Tonight
and
Show.
And the mistake that I made growing up is like, you know, he would do comedy on, you know, on the Tonight Show. Well, we always thought he was funny. We would watch it. But then years later, maybe 10 years ago, I got to hear him do stand-up. And I'm like, it's so much more edgy. you know, my wife will only handle so much. Like if you get into like a certain level of crude, she won't go. So I have to go by myself. So he's like right there on the edge of certain.
Jay Leno's on the edge, really?
Oh, dude, I thought so. Really? So Shell had a big launch for a new oil product about 10 years ago when we were there, and he's like a fucking machine gun, dude. Like you get about so in that 45-minute set, you get at least an hour and a half worth of material. It is just coming. Fucking rapid fire.
That's interesting. I gotta go see him live then because I haven't seen him. I think he's live dynamite. In a long time. I don't know like where he's working out or if he just does big shows.
So I don't know.
He used to do Comedy Magic Club every Sunday.
I see his stuff pops up, you know, on my, you know, social media feeds like when he's around or in the area. So he does shows. I mean,
yeah.
But it would, to your point, reach out to him or I'll give you his number and you reach out to him and have him come do the mothership.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I mean,
he used to be really respected as like an edgy comic when he first started.
Yeah,
he in the 1970s, like when he would do like I guess it was the early 80s or late 70s, we'd do Letterman.
I used to watch him on Letterman. He'd wear like a black leather jacket.
What year was that?
This would have been probably mid 80s, 84, 85, and they used to do a little gag called Jay, what's your beef? Eh, what's my beef? Kind of a grumpy old man program. But yeah, I always thought Jay was pretty good. You know, I love Carson when Carson was on back in the day too. So you know, you just kind of go from one to the next. But I'm like you know, some of the current stuff. You got Gutfeld, who's I think funny as shit. But the other guys,
it's a hard gig, man.
Yeah,
because there's so many restrictions. Like first of all, you're talking to someone very quickly.
Yeah,
if you're going to talk to them about something complex. Something that's difficult to
grasp.
That's
why the long-form podcast works, right?
100%.
Yeah, okay.
Because if you're just talking to someone and you're talking to them for 5 minutes and then you go into commercial, it's like you can only get so into the subject.
Yeah.
And some subjects deserve more attention. They deserve time. And you really can't do it on those shows. And then also you're censored, right? So you can't say certain words. You can't speak your mind. You'll have a producer in your ear telling you what to do. And then on top of that, you have these commercials. You have to wait for the commercial. Then you got to build momentum back up when you're back. All right, we're back. You know, like, why are we back? Like, what is this? Like, it's the worst way to have conversations. And that's essentially what those things are.
Right.
What those things are is just, it's like short attention span, quick soundbite conversations that are not satisfying.
Right.
That's the problem.
Like,
to get a satisfying conversation, you need to talk to someone for a long time.
Okay.
And so they're crippled. It's like they're handicapped by the system that they exist in.
Okay.
So there's nothing you can do to fix it.
But was it that much different from when Carson and Lena were doing it? I mean,
yes, because
today's
podcasts.
A lot worse.
Well, there's podcasts now.
Oh, so
now
they have competition.
No,
there was nothing else to watch back then.
Now people see it. This is what it is. It's like they see the difference because if all the only. Conversations you see with people having on television are on things like The Tonight Show, then that seems normal.
Yeah.
But as soon as you can have long form, full, uncensored
deep dive, unpack it all.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's when it becomes awkward because then you're like, why are they doing it like this?
Interesting.
Like, this is an uncomfortable way to watch people talk. And also, like, someone's sitting there and you're sitting next to them in this weird way and you're facing a crowd.
You've got a live audience.
It's all weird. There's so much weirdness to it.
That's funny. You
know? It's just not a good way to have a good conversation.
Right.
You know, and all it was really was an advertisement for whatever the fuck that person was selling.
Okay.
So if this
their
person,
book, their whatever.
A sitcom, a new record.
Yeah, new movie.
Yeah, that's really what it is.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, and Jay Leno didn't get a chance to pick the guests. Like, he wasn't, like, up to him, you know.
Well, he did tell me, we worked with him on a project a couple of years ago. And we're just sitting in a truck bullshitting. And, you know, I kind of asked him, I said, so since you don't do The Tonight Show, do you miss any of that at all? He's like, nah, not really. He's like, I wasn't really big on going to movies. So if somebody's coming on the show, I'd go watch the movie just so I knew what to talk about. But he's like, I'm really not into celebrities and I don't go to the movies that much. I do my car thing, you know?
Well, for Jay Leno and for all those comedians that lived back then, The Tonight Show was the holy grail.
Oh, for sure.
It was.
If you're a young comedian, you get on there. That's
the Tonight
that's
Show,
it.
The host of the Letterman Show, the host of like some late night show. That was the holy grail.
Right.
So they all wanted that. And so when, you know, you get it and you realize like, oh, is this really what I wanted? But it just was, it was a thing that it seemed like no one could get.
Right.
And back then, if you got it, it was a big deal.
Sure.
I mean, if you were the host of The Tonight Show, it was a big deal.
Right.
And nowadays, it's like, It's just another show.
Right.
You know, it's just another thing that's on television.
They got to compete with you.
Well, they're not even competing. It's like they're competing with Netflix, really.
Okay.
They're competing with things. But if they, for conversations, yeah, they're competing. Well, Bill Maher is a podcast now.
Right.
There's a lot of great podcasters. If you want just free entertainment in your ears, you could, there's so much. There's so many different
true
crime shows, and so many different stand-up comedians have podcasts, and so many scientists. And fuck, man. I mean, you could just be entertained forever. So breaking into that is hard.
Right.
And when you're on a television show, like, you're kind of depending upon people flipping through the channels, or people that are accustomed to watching it at 11 p.m., let's turn on the late night show.
Right.
You know?
Huh.
It's kind of a trap, though.
It is.
It's a trap.
I had no idea.
They don't grow. It's like, so, they're very, they're like the viewership of those things just keeps dwindling.
So where, like, the young comedians, where do they, so you didn't get your big break by going on Leno or going on Carson or something like that, but like you found the right manager. It's like, for a young comedian that's trying to get going, where, how do they get discovered today?
The YouTube.
Okay.
YouTube, internet, social media. Someone could be funny and have one clip about one subject that resonates with people, and they throw it up on their Instagram, and then it gets reposted and shared.
Yeah.
They put it up on Twitter. It's on YouTube, and then bam, all of a sudden they're famous.
Right.
It happens all the time now.
Wow.
This is a great time for people to get their stuff out there. Like, probably the greatest time ever.
So if you've got talent, you can't keep it down.
Yeah, it's hard. It's genuine. I mean, you know.
At least people know about it.
I mean, there's definitely some people that get better breaks than other people. That definitely happens. But at the end of the day, really, it's about, like, becoming undeniable. And if you can just put your stuff out there and enough people love it.
Yeah.
So that's where they get their big break today. Well, you know, back in my day, I got on the MTV Half Hour Comedy Hour. That was, like, the first television show that I did, where I got attention from it, and then I got a development deal. So that was like the pathway back then. It was like you would do a stand-up comedy TV show, and then you try to get a sitcom. And everybody just wanted a sitcom, or they wanted to host The Tonight Show, or host The Jimmy Kimmel Show, or whatever, your own show. But there wasn't a lot of those.
Did you ever do it? I mean, you did Fear Factor, but did you ever host like a show like where you're interviewing people? Or
I
like
did. I guest hosted once later with Greg Kinnear. He was out of town.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I guest hosted.
Okay,
it was fun. I enjoyed it. But it's still very limited. It's just not, it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like doing this is like the perfect version of conversations for me.
Yeah.
Some people like it more restricted, and they want to be wearing a suit. They want the lights, and they want the crowd, and they feel like it's more of a show. And
sure.
I get it. There's all kinds of different things that people like, but for me, this is the most fun way to do it. How's a gummy bear treating you?
I'm
faded.
I'm buzzing pretty good.
You look a little faded, fella.
Yeah.
Doesn't he? I can smell it. I can smell you went to the dark lands.
I brought my son. He can drive me home.
Good.
No autopilot for me tonight.
Yeah, none of that.
That's funny.
That's Ric Flair. Woo!
Woo!
Woo chews. Texas has got to get its shit together with weed. It's weird that some
weed
is legal. Weed is legal. Like Delta 9 is legal.
Fairly weed.
I got a quick weed story for you. So this ties into Cold Plunge. So I got diagnosed as ADHD back in the late 90s. So I've been married for a while, and we're having trouble. And like, my counselor gives me this book and says, answer these 100 questions, and if you're more than 80 of them, then you're ADHD. I was 98 out of 100. So I started taking Ritalin, okay?
Whoa.
And I've been taking Ritalin, you know, for almost 25 years. So fast forward to a couple months ago, I go to my doctor, to the clinic, to go get my prescription refill because it's a controlled substance, like Adderall or opioids or whatever else. And look, for me, it just wakes me up in the morning. I don't drink coffee, and it kind of helps me stay focused on the stuff I've got to do and better follow through and focus. And so I go in, and the nurse says, well, we have a new policy at the clinic. In order to get a refill for Ritalin or any other controlled substance, we have to drug test you. And I said, okay, all right, whatever, once a year. And so I started filling out some paperwork. I'm like, she's like, okay, well, tell me now when you want to go pee in the cup. And I said, you're going to drug test me now? I said, I'm 60 years old. I've never been drug tested in my life. And it just pissed me off. I'm like, I'm paying money to be here. I just want my Ritalin. So I stopped taking it. And so like for 30 days, I'm kind of like, oh man, I got a little less energy, a little less focus. Well, then I've been watching you and other friends cold plunging.
Are you allowed to just get off of Ritalin like that?
You're not supposed to cold turkey it, but yeah, I did.
Were you on a fairly low dose?
Yeah, it was 20 milligrams in the morning, 10 in the afternoon, but I normally didn't take the afternoon. But here's what I found, that for the 30 days following, it wasn't that hard of a real transition. I was just a little more lethargic and needed to get to the gym more. But what I learned is that my level of aggression with my kids, my wife, my employees was ratcheted down by probably 20%.
From the cold?
Well,
or
no,
from the Ritalin?
So this me stopped taking Ritalin.
Okay.
And my resting heart rate was lower. And so I thought, what can I do? So
Ritalin was just jacking you up.
It was jacking me up. But it had been jacking me up for 25 years. And then friction I would have with employees, or I would want to, you know, get into tussles on just stupid shit. And so this recent revelation is the, you know, clinic wanting to drug test me so I could get my Ritalin refill. Me not taking the Ritalin, I believe, well, my wife and kids at least tell me this, so a few employees, that I'm just I don't have to take gummy bears to calm down at times, right? Mm. I'll take a gummy bear sometimes to go to sleep. But then I thought, okay, well, what can help kind of replace, kind of give me that kick in the ass in the morning, so kind of wake me up and get me going? And I'll go do an early workout, a boxing workout a couple times a week. But I'm like, I need something else. I've been seeing you and other people doing the cold plunge program. And that's like, and I had done it a few times before I got off the Ritalin, but I thought, like, okay, the last time I did that, that like gave me like this boost of focus, like this mental focus and more calm through the day. Hmm. So I bought a cold plunge tank, and I got it about 3 weeks ago, and cold plunge maybe 5 days a week in the morning. And I don't know, maybe it's just because it's a combination of, it's something that I really don't want to do and it's really hard to do. And when I say that to myself, I'm like, that's the very reason I need to go do it. And then secondarily, just like it shocks my system and all of a sudden it just wakes me up. So I'm like, you know, so if you're listening out there and you're on Ritalin, your kid's on Ritalin, you know, I'm not a doctor, I'm not telling you what to do, but I am saying that I got off of Ritalin and now I can kind of backfill that boost of energy in the morning by doing a cold plunge.
That's interesting that you were on it for 25 years and you're able to get off of it in 30 days. Like, what did that transition feel like? Because I would imagine that you'd kind of become dependent on the feeling that you get from
that. So I would run out from time to time. I never felt dependent on it, but I did feel lower energy.
Hmm.
Especially the last 10 years as I've gotten older, I'm like, okay. You know, I've never really been a morning person. I used to, like, up till maybe 10 years ago, wouldn't go to bed till 2 or 3 in the morning, and then I'd wake up at, you know, 7 or 8 the next day. But anyway, so the Ritalin just kind of gets me going, helps me focus, stay on task. But it probably starts wearing off kind of by mid-afternoon, but I just didn't.
The thing about that kind of stuff to me is if you can function as good as you're functioning without it, I wonder, because we think of medications as being necessary.
Yeah.
We think of things like that as being necessary, like this is what you need, it'll straighten you out. Is it? You know, I mean, it is what we're missing, like at least with some people, is what they're missing, physical activity and stressors, things like cold and heat.
Yeah.
And things like a morning workout. Like, how many people are just going to a pill and not doing those other things to see if, like, maybe there's a more healthy way to approach this?
Yeah. I mean, just how much, you know, how much time, like, do I waste just glancing at my phone? Who texted me? What's on the news? What about pool cues? Whatever, mm-hmm. you know? And so one of the things I noticed when we first installed it, maybe it was the first or second time that I'd cold plunge at home, like I was kind of had this euphoria. I don't know if it's kind of for a little bit of a dump of endorphins or dopamine or what, but just kind of me being happy. I didn't one time wonder, where's my phone? What's going on?
Mm.
And my counselor tells me that just by looking at our phone, sometimes that gives us a tiny little dopamine hit.
Yeah, it does.
Look at the phone. So
it's also just an addiction. You're just like looking for new information constantly. Yeah. You're always looking for some new picture, new video, new thing to like stimulate you.
So that's why I found the cold plunge kind of just for a period of time. I'm like, it was calm. It was like zen. It's like me being up in the mountains, looking at the trees and just kind of being a peaceful moment without having to, you know, take a Ric Flair gummy bear.
Well, it definitely makes you so happy when you get out of it.
Yeah.
And you get out of it like, woo. You're like,
I'm happy just because I'm not freezing my balls off anymore.
Yeah, it's that. But it's really just the rush of endorphins. You feel so happy.
Yeah, that's true.
Norepinephrine.
And our family's doing it. My wife did it. My daughter comes over and does it. Son's real athletic. He's got two scope knees. And so he thought he tweaked his knee playing pickleball the other day. And he did it and said, no more pain. So, I mean, you as an athlete, I mean, and still probably training pretty hard, do you find like when your body's getting a little worn or your joints are a little sore, does a cold plunge help you too?
I do it every day, so I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I still have joint pain. Okay. I still have like some stuff, but that's just what comes with the territory.
Okay.
Yeah, it is what it is. You just get accustomed to being in some sort of pain most of the time.
Right. Okay.
You know, especially jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu training, like you're always hurt. There's always something going on.
What do you still carry to this day that you got hurt doing back in the day?
Oh, I've had a bunch of surgeries. Okay. I've had my knees reconstructed, both my knees reconstructed.
Okay.
It's a lot of it is joint stuff and back stuff. Like everybody that I know that does jiu-jitsu has some sort of a back issue or a neck issue.
So does weed or hallucinogens, does that help any with, is it more for your mind stimulation or relaxation, or does it help with any of your injuries?
I don't know if it helps with injuries. It definitely reduces inflammation, but there's a good argument that maybe inflammation is good for some injuries.
Oh, really?
Because it's how the body's healing from it.
Okay.
Like there's
unless it's your arteries.
What's that?
Unless you've got inflammation in your arteries.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah.
But inflammation from injuries. There's like two schools of thought. And one school of thought is you should ice things immediately and calm down the inflammation. And the other school of thought is really what you need is heat and motion. And you need to kind of like let the body do its normal process. And there's a reason why it's inflamed following an injury. It's sending a lot of blood to that area. It's trying to fix it. I don't know. I'm not smart enough. I've heard from very smart people both things you should do. I've heard you should ice things, and I've heard you should never ice things. I don't know what to say about that, but I do know that it does inhibit your growth and gains if you do it post lifting.
Okay.
So like if you lift weights and then you jump into the cold right afterwards, the reduction of inflammation actually equals less growth. So you get less what they call hypertrophy.
Did you talk about some guy that was doing cold plunges before his morning workout?
That's what
I do.
And
that was boosting testosterone?
Yes, we read about that. Okay. There was a guy that he had some sort of a test that showed that he might have cancer.
Okay.
And they wanted to put him on certain medications, and he said, I want to try doing a ketogenic diet and doing the cold plunge every day. And so this guy shifted his diet and went to doing a cold plunge every day before his workouts. And his testosterone rocketed.
Wow.
All of his problems went away.
Wow.
He started feeling way healthier.
Right.
But I think sometimes people need like a little bit of a wake-up call just to kind of straighten up your diet.
Yeah.
And maybe it doesn't need to be keto, but maybe the benefit wasn't really from him doing keto, which may have been a benefit, but it also might have been when you're doing keto, you're not eating any bullshit. Like you can't eat potato chips, you can't like drink soda.
Yeah.
Like you only get a certain amount of carbs per day.
Right.
So you're trying to get your body into this state where it's just burning fat, and just by doing that, you're eliminating bullshit. And that's probably what's fucking with people more than anything. It's just bad food.
Do you cook your own food, or you have somebody?
Yeah, I cook my own food. Okay. Yeah, I cook a lot.
What Wow, gummy bear moment.
Gummy bears are your friends, but sometimes they fuck you. They leave you searching for your thoughts. Yeah. No, I love cooking. I really do. I love cooking meat, you know, especially like game meat, like wild game.
Yeah, I see your Instagram with some of that elk stuff looks like, man, I'll be right over.
I love it. I love cooking ribeyes too.
Right.
Because I like to eat, I eat mostly meat, so I try to eat a lot of fat. Because I'm not getting much else.
Do you take, so like when you go to, you know, go on the road for a fight or doing stand up. You bring like a cooler. You bring your stuff.
No,
some of your
just
stuff.
Go to restaurants.
Okay. Okay.
No,
okay.
I ain't got time for fucking
do you much with intermittent fasting?
Yeah, I do that all the time.
Okay.
Yeah. Generally, I do at least 14 hours.
Okay.
So I generally like to work out in the morning fasted.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
But it depends. Like sometimes, like if I have a show late at night, like last night my show was pretty late.
Right.
And I was home until like 2:30 in the morning.
Okay.
So then I had some food at night because I was just exhausted and tired.
Sure.
So then I ate and then I went to sleep and I woke up later.
Right.
So when I woke up, I just ate and then got my shit done because I'm like, listen, the fasting's out the window.
Right.
I got tanked last night. Let's just like get something in and, you know, get the sweat going and let's get rocking and then
kind of get your body back.
But I do the
track.
Cold plunge before anything.
Okay.
Before any of my workouts.
I'm gonna try that out.
I'm so accustomed to it now. It still sucks. Like I still hate it. I still think about
chicken.
But
it's necessary.
Well, it is really good for you, and it, I feel so great when I get out of it. And more importantly, it's made my body much more resilient to cold. Like, I warm up really quickly.
Yeah.
Like, once I'm out, like, I do the 3 minutes, and I remember the first time I did, I was fucking cold for so long. It's like, oh, you fucker. Oh, you fucking bitch. You dummy. What is wrong with you? Why are you doing this? Now I get out, and I'm like, woof. Like, my body's completely adapted to it. So I can start working out right away.
How cold? What temperature do you find it?
34.
Oh, you go that low?
Yeah, I do 34 for 3 minutes every morning.
Wow. Do you have a chiller? Do you have ice or both?
I have a Marasco cold plunge at home, at Marasco Forge. And here we have one called the Blue Cube.
Okay.
And they're both very, very good.
I want to see that. I bought one from Renew.
I'll show you the Blue Cube.
Okay.
It's out here. The Blue Cube we have at the studio. And the Blue Cube, they're upgrading to this fucking insane one they have now that's like a river.
Okay.
So you don't get a thermal layer over your body. So when you
the water's constantly circulating.
Exactly. So it just
like you're sitting in a river,
sucking.
Okay.
It never stops sucking.
Oh, that's going to super chill your ass.
Yeah, because when you get in the Marasco, it's amazing. And look, it ain't easy. Three minutes is a grind.
At that temperature? Oh, my gosh.
But after a minute and a half or so, it gets more relaxed.
Okay.
And that's because you develop a thermal layer. Because when you get out, you know how your body gets like super red?
Yeah.
Right? That's what that is.
Okay.
That's your body is forcing blood to try to warm up your skin that's in contact with this cold. It's trying to prevent you from hypothermia.
It's giving you some insulation.
Yes.
Okay.
And so this Blue Cube one doesn't allow that because it's like constantly running.
Flowing through.
It's constantly flowing. So it's torturous.
Gosh. Wow. Yeah. I'm a wuss. I'm only down to 55 degrees.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
I know.
I shower in that.
I'm sure you do.
That's outrageous.
You got ice cubes coming out of your shower.
I like cold showers too.
Yeah.
In the winter, it's the greatest.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it in the winter. Oh, in the winter, it feels so good. I love doing it right after the sauna.
Yeah.
Right into the
cold
shower.
That's what I was going to ask you. So, where does the dry sauna come in with cold plunge in the workout?
It depends entirely on what kind of workout I'm doing.
All right.
Like, what I really generally like to do is I like to work out by doing cold plunge first, always. And then I will have, like, whatever workout I'm in. And if I'm doing hard cardio, like if I'm doing bag workout or something like that, then I go right into the sauna afterwards.
Okay.
So my heart rate is jacked.
Okay.
So when my heart rate, like when, you know, my resting, my heart rate after rounds, like I'll do like 10 rounds on the bag, and it's still beating fast when I go in. So, and then... Right. Because of the heat, like it's a static form of cardio. So when
you're
go in,
extending your workout.
Exactly.
Okay.
I'm extending my workout just sitting there and listening to a book.
Okay.
So I'll just put if you want to do that though, get AirPod ones, the originals.
So slide out or?
No, the original ones don't overheat.
Oh, really?
The other ones die out.
Okay.
Every fucking, I've tried a bunch of different companies, a bunch of different they all die except the original, regular AirPods. Whichever one they sell, they'll sell like a Gen 2, but it's not the new ones.
Yeah.
It's the old ones.
Yeah.
The ones in the little tiny case.
Yes, sure.
Those ones don't die.
Okay.
Because they have less shit in them.
Interesting.
Like the other ones have noise canceling and all that. They die quick. The pros, they eat alive.
Yeah.
And it's always the left one because I'm sitting with my left side to the heater.
Okay.
So it made me conscious of like switching sides.
So cold plunge, workout, if you got your heart rate up, definitely go straight into the dry sauna.
Yeah.
And then do you ever rotate
back? Sometimes
back?
Even when I lift weights, I'll go into the sauna. It depends on how much time I have. But what I really like is a sauna at night.
Okay.
I really like that when I come home from the club.
For bed. Yeah.
It relaxes you for bed, but it also centers my mind. And it gives me an opportunity to have just a little bit more adversity at the end of the day. Go through 20 minutes of this fucking 189 degree sauna and steam and just and listening to something.
Okay.
Generally, I'm listening to a book.
Okay.
And I'm just in there just thinking about shit.
You know?
It gives you, it's good alone time. I need alone time. Like it's very important.
When's your alone time that you're not listening to the book? You're not thinking about, you know, learning.
When I'm working out. When I'm working out.
Okay.
Yeah, when I'm working out, it's just alone time.
Yeah.
You know, like if I'm hitting the bag, either I listen to music or sometimes I don't listen to anything. I just want to hear the thumps. I just want to hear the whomp, whomp.
You ever been in a fast go-kart?
Like not a fast one. We were in Thailand.
Okay.
I think it was in Thailand with my family.
Yeah.
And we went to this place. They rent go-karts. We were like whipping around. And they're fun as shit. We were racing each other. It was a really good time.
But yeah, but like a really fast, like a track-focused go-kart, like for me, like that's something that will take my mind off of everything. Because maybe a little bit like boxing or something in that if I'm not focused at what I'm doing, I'm either going to fucking lose or get fucking hurt or both.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, I just,
well, that's why I
skiing
like,
fast and go-karts are what take my mind off of.
But without getting hurt, you could do that with pool. That's what I like
true,
about
to
pool.
Some degree.
And that's what I like about archery as well. Yeah, okay. Archery, it's like when you're drawn back.
A little bit of zen.
Yeah, it's there's a thing that's happening where it's so difficult to do that all you're thinking about is that thing, and it's very mind-cleansing. Because Fred Bear said that, something about a troubled man and a bow. Like
right,
Fred Bear was like one of the original pioneers of bow hunting in this country.
Yeah.
But pool, to me, is like one of the ultimate ones because you could do it at any time you want. Anytime you have time.
Yeah.
I can just go out there and set some drills up or just run some balls, and it just frees my mind.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're a good pool player. Sure. When you're making a long shot, especially a shot on that table,
right.
And you know you have to get pinpoint position on the next ball, there's, like, so much going on.
Did you ever play any street pool growing
up?
Yeah,
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I never really played one pocket, but I played a lot of street pool.
I played a little bit of one pocket. It just kind of – it's like a chess match. It's boring as shit. I like action, you know, so –
I get it.
Yeah.
It's hard to do. I get it. It's a great gambling game.
Yeah.
Like those guys who that are really the Tony Chohans.
Grady
of the
Matthews.
World. Yeah. Those
they're chess masters is what they are.
It's an intellectual game.
Yeah.
Efren Reyes is amazing at it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not my thing. I like rotation.
Right, right.
I like breaking.
Yeah, sure.
I like running out.
All right, man. Well, I'm your pool table date. Just let me know.
We're going to do this
more often. Hour and a half drive up from the factory.
We had a good time.
Yeah,
today was fun. We just didn't have enough time.
That's all good.
That's the thing. It's like you just get warmed up when you play for like an hour or two.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, listen, brother, I appreciate you coming here, and I love your cars, man, and I appreciate you making wild shit.
Likewise, I just
love that you do that. You just make wild shit. You know, like whenever I look at your website, he's like, he's got a 1,000 horsepower Camaro. Like, what the fuck are you doing? An Exorcist. Like, Jesus Christ, man.
Do.
Like, everything is just so bonkers
over the top.
All of it. The GT500, not fast enough.
Yeah.
What, does it only have 700 horsepower?
No, we built a 1,000 horsepower.
Exactly, but from the factory. 700 from the factory.
We built a 1,000 horsepower GT500 for Jim Farley, the CEO, and he, his son, went out and drove around. Monterey, California last August and had a blast with it.
The fucking videos that you guys have of like
it's
people
fun.
Sitting in the car and you see the acceleration.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I love that you're out there, brother. Appreciate
you
very much.
Appreciate you.
And thank you for being here. It was a lot
of fun.
Thank
you. Awesome.
All right. Goodbye.